Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to another edition of Blue Shirt Banner Radio. I'm Jim, and my partner and co-host, my friend, he's on the line. Eddie, good evening. How are you?
Good evening, and I'm glad to be here. I'm really excited about tonight's program. Emil the Cat Francis Ranger Royalty, and he's raring and ready to go, and I got a lot of stuff to talk about as far as the Rangers go as well.
Absolutely. We got the trade we're going to talk about in a little while. First, without further ado, let's get right to it. Emil, good evening. Welcome to the program. Jim and Eddie with you. How are you?
Hi, Jim, Eddie. I'm very good, thank you, except I can't get to play golf too much down here. The last couple of weeks we've had nothing but rain, but I guess that's better than snow.
That's true. You'll have plenty of sunshine before you know it, Emil.
Oh, I'm sure.
So we want to talk about a bunch of different things with you. Why don't we start with you were talking a little bit before we went on the air about the trade the Rangers made. Why don't you give us your thoughts on the deal the Rangers made last night that finally finished it up?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I was hoping, of course, that they could have got Sanu from Calgary, but a lot of teams are trying to probably get him because, you know, he's a big, tough defenseman. In fact, just before I came on here, I was watching him play. Toronto were playing, like, you know, and I was watching him, and I thought the first period he played very well. He got in a couple of fights, and he knocked 3 or 4 people down in front of the net. And I think Toronto made a real good deal for him, like, you know. And it was a 7-player deal. And I've been involved in a couple of those. And when it's all over, people say, well, who do you think got the best part of the deal? And to me, the guy who gets the best deal is the guy who gets the best player. And I'd bet my house on the fact that Fanouf is the best player in that 7-player deal. And he'll help Toronto, believe me. But getting back to the Rangers, like, you know, I've seen Olli Jokinen play since I've been retired, been in Florida. I've seen him play many times. And he's an offensive sentiment, and there's no doubt they need offense, and he'll surely will help the people that he play with, like, you know. Well, last year he was traded about halfway through the year from Florida, from the Panthers to Calgary. And would you believe that he'd been here for 8 years, never been in the playoffs? So last year was the first year he was in the playoffs. So he's not exactly a guy who's been in the playoffs and had a lot of playoff experience. But I think considering the fact that they have problems putting the puck in the net, that he surely will help the guys that he play with. Plus, he can score goals himself. He should help them for where they need help there. But I'd like to see him get a little help in that blue line.
Yeah. I mean, you're right.
Yeah.
Dion Phaneuf is kind of a throwback, Emil. He can hit, he can fight, he can clear that net, and he can score, which, I mean, that's unique, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's got one of the best shots from the point on the power play, which would hit their ranges exactly where they need it. I mean, if they somehow or other could have got him, he'd have really solved a lot of problems as far as their power play is concerned, as far as their toughness of defense is concerned. But I'm sure that, you know, Calgary wanted a package, and whether they got exactly what they wanted, they got 4 guys, but I guess time will tell. But like I said, when I look at a deal, I don't care if there's 2 guys involved or 7 guys involved like that was. I'll take the deal where the best player is, and I'm sure that Toronto got the best player in Phaneuf. I play with Chicago Blackhawks, And we had a pony line called Doug Bentley, Max Bentley, and Billy Mosaico. And they were one of the, there's only six teams in the league, and they had to be at least the second or third best line in the league. And all of a sudden, Blackhawks decided, Billy Mosaico broke his leg in the first All-Star game. We won one of the first five. And they traded Max Bentley to the Toronto Maple Leafs for five players. We got Ernie Dickens. We got Gus Bodner. We got Bud Poile. We got five guys for Max Bentley. But we never made the playoffs for 3 years, and Toronto went on and won three Stanley Cups the next 4 years because Max Bentley was a top center. He led the league in scoring for 2 years prior to him being traded. He played the point on the power play, and they had Phil Apps and Ted Kennedy and Max Bentley. They had three of the best centers in the league. They went on and won three Stanley Cups the next 4 years because they got the best player.
Right, and that, like you said, that's the key to any trade. You got to get the best player, and Toronto definitely got the best player.
Yep, absolutely. Yep. I would have loved to have seen that guy end up with the Rangers, believe me, but I guess, you know.
Boy. We'd all be flying
high. He just solved the power play. He's got a great shot from the point. He's a big, tough guy in front of the net. I mean, he could move the – I mean, he'd have hit a home run for the Rangers, believe me. And I'm sure they had their nose in there. I hope they did.
Well, the Rangers usually have their nose in just about everything when a big name comes available.
Right.
Just like in your day, right?
Yep.
I want to ask you a question. You know, the rumors of the trade first started circulating, I guess it was Sunday, and then the deal finally got done last night after the game. What can you tell us, give us a little insight on how these trades go down? How did they go down in your day? How did you go about making deals? I mean, I know you made a lot of deals in your day. How did they all come about?
Well, it comes about because, like, you know, you have scouts, and you're looking at every team in the league, and you're looking at your own team, and you're looking, and you make calls. I always made a point, like, you know, from the time when I took over, there was only six teams in the league, and when I finished, there was 30. But I made a call. When there were six teams, I made at least that. I called two teams every day. Every day. Monday, I'd call this two teams. Next day, two. Just to always have a feel of what's going on there, like, you know. And you always watch, like, you know, who's doing what and whether they lost or whether they won. And if they got in a losing streak, you'd call and say, well, how's everything going? Like, oh, you knew how it was going. That's what you're calling, like, you know. Just to get the feel of exactly, like, you know, are they proposing to try to trade somebody? Like, when I ended up in the, I traded Park and Rattel to Boston for Esposito and Vadnais, like, you know, they were playing terrible and we were playing terrible. And we went on, you know, after about, each had lost about six in a row, and I called Sinden. We never made a deal with Boston, but I called him. I said, well, what are you going to do about trying to get out of what's happening there? He said, well, geez, I don't know. He says, how about this guy, that guy? I said, well, I said, I'll think about it. I'll get back to you. And then we started throwing around names, like, you know, after about 3 days, I said, Harry, I mean, the guys we're talking about are the twos and threes, the deuces and the threes. They're not the reason we're losing. And we're going to try to get out of what the hell we're doing. We're going to have to start talking about key guys on the team. Well, he said, who would you talk about? I said, well, I'll talk about anybody you want. Because at that point in time, I knew I had to make a move, like, you know. He said, well, would you talk about Park? I said, yeah, I'd talk about Park. If you talk about Orr, oh, I've never played Orr. You know, and that's how it starts, like, you know. But you start talking about one thing, and when you end up, it can be a completely different thing. But it's just keeping in touch with everybody. And keeping your finger, you know, on the pulse of what's going on with every team in the league. Like, I was really surprised when I heard about 10 days ago that Calgary were even thinking of trading Fanouf. I said, oh, man. Oh, I would be on that phone every day with that team. You know, I was really surprised that they're even thinking of trading him.
I really didn't catch up with that story. Why would you even have a guy like that available? I mean, really.
I don't know.
I know it's premature in the guy's career, but from what I saw, I mean, you don't want to tab a guy a future Hall of Famer, but this guy was the complete package. Why would you get rid of a player like that?
Well, and it's not over his contract. He's got a contract. He's got 2 years in a contract. It's not like Bullmeister down here in Florida last year, like, you know, Florida tried to sign him, And he'd been here 6 years. They'd missed the playoffs every year. And he had his mind made up that these guys weren't going to try to build a competitive club. And he was out of here. And they tried to sign him, but he wouldn't even talk to him. Like, they tried to sign him because they needed him badly, but he wouldn't even talk to him because he knew and his agent knew that he was leaving here. And he did leave. He ended up in Calgary, like, you know. But I'll tell you, Bo Bassler is no Phaneuf. When you look at Phaneuf, you got to say, well, what could have happened? And it's not over contract because he's got a contract, and he's got a contract right for another couple of years. So sometimes, you know, it's not exactly – it can't be a problem with management because you signed. It could be the coach, and they got a new coach. They brought in Brent Sutter, you know, the general manager is his brother, and he's the coach. He coached New Jersey last year. Maybe it's got something to do with that, you know, and maybe you take a dislike to one another. I mean, but I never, ever moved a player because me and that player didn't get along. If that player was good enough to play for me, shit, he was going to play. I mean, hey, little things like that didn't bother me a bit, like, you know. And I can't imagine, and I'd like to know why. I mean, I'll find out eventually, but I don't know now. But there had to be some kind of a reason. I don't know what it is.
Now,
you know, go ahead, Jim.
I just want to ask real quick, with players that Emil, that maybe you didn't get along with or didn't get along with you, did you just have to find a way to coexist with them, or did you adapt a little bit to them or make them adapt a little bit to you? How did you deal with that?
Well, you know, I ran a hockey club like you'd run an army, on discipline, on and off the ice. And I tell you, you either played my way or you were out of there, like, you know. Because I had a system. You had to play that system. But most of the guys that I got in trades, or the guys that come to me, I had no problem with them at all because they love to be disciplined. They love to play a system, and they wanted to play for a team that wanted to win. So I really didn't have any trouble with players, like, you know. The only guy probably that I dealt, and I got him because we needed toughness, and I dealt him, was Reg Fleming. And I didn't have a problem with him except a couple times, like, you know, he said, how come I'm not getting more ice time? I said, you play and I'll coach and I'll tell you what to do. If you don't like what I'm doing, you're out of here. Simple as that, you know. That's the way I operate. So I really didn't have any problems, like, you know. But I was lucky, too, because not only was a coach, I was a general manager. And the general manager wasn't going to fire the coach. You know what I mean?
And if they didn't like the coach, there was nobody to complain to, right?
Exactly.
You were chief cook and bottle washer with that team.
You got it.
For those of you just joining us, in case you don't know, we have the great Emil Francis on the phone with us again tonight. He was nice enough to come on the show again. You're listening to Blue Shirt Banner Radio. And, Eddie, why don't you explain what we got going on tonight?
Well, you know, Emil, I like to surprise you. I surprised you last time. We had Gilles Vellemure on.
Yeah,
and
great
guy. Yeah, later on the show, I got another blast from the past I'm going to bring. But right now we have a guy on the line that's written a book. His name is Jay Moran. And Jay wrote a really wonderful book called The Rangers, the Bruins, and the End of an Era. And we thought we'd bring Jay on, and possibly Jay, I'm sure Jay would love to talk to you. And I know, you know, we've had little discussions that really, you know, this subject, you can go over it and over and it never gets dull. So we'd like to bring Jay Moran on. And Jay, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Jay,
how you doing, Jay?
Yep. Hey, Mr. Francis, good to hear from you again.
Yeah, and thank you very much for sending me a copy of your book. I enjoyed it very much.
Oh, terrific, that's great.
Terrific book.
Oh, I couldn't have written it without you, that's for sure.
Yeah, right. Well, and you know who I play with. I mean, I'd have never played golf with that guy ever, ever, ever. But now a fellow by the name of Harry Sinden, who's the general manager of the Boston Bruins, and myself, we play and belong to the same golf club. Now we play golf together. Like, you know, I mean, I wouldn't have played with that guy in a game of golf if I lived to be 100. But now, you know, I'm retired, and he's here, and Bill Torrey's here, and Bob Pulford from the Blackhawks is here. This is like a little National League center here in West Palm Beach, you know. But,
I like to be a fly in the wall there.
Oh, gosh. Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, so we have a lot of fun, I mean, but funny, we play golf. We never talk about hockey.
Oh.
But it's good to have all the guys here.
Hey, I have a couple questions for you.
Yeah.
When I interviewed you for the book, I forgot to ask you about your trainer, Frank Pace. I mean, he was with the club so long. There must be a story or two you could tell us about him.
Oh, Frank Pace was a trainer of the New York Rangers for 30 years. And, I mean, there wasn't a more dedicated person in hockey than him. Like, you know, he started out like when the Rangers used to play in Montreal, he was a stick boy. And he was always a stick boy for the visiting team. And in those days, Frank Boucher was the coach of the Rangers, and Lester Patrick was the general manager. And they took a liking to him, and they said, how about would you be interested in coming to New York to be the trainer for the New York Rovers? You remember Boston had the Olympics, and the Rangers had the Rovers. Like, you know, they played in the Eastern League. And he came to New York, and he was the trainer of the New York Rovers, which played in that Eastern Amateur League. And when finally the trainer of the Rangers retired, they made him the trainer of the New York Rangers. And, of course, I played for the Rangers. I knew Frank. And then when I took over the Rangers, I mean, I inherited him. And he was the most dedicated person you ever want to meet. He was a great guy, like, you know, terrific person. He died here about 10 years ago. He's retired and living here in Florida, like, you know. But, yeah, Frank was a great guy. I used to tell him, if you keep yapping off of those referees, if you ever get a bench penalty, I'm going to fine you $200. Now you keep your mouth shut. Oh, he used to yell at the referee. Geez, I knew he was going to get us in trouble. Like, but, you know, he wanted the Rangers to win so bad, like, because he'd been there through so many losing seasons, like, you know. But I'll tell you, the trainers in those days, they had to do everything. I mean, you wouldn't believe it. They had no assistants. I mean, they had to fix the equipment. They had to, they looked after everything. I mean, a trainer, when we had a 16 league, they were the greatest guys going. When I broke in with Chicago Blackhawks, the trainer of the Blackhawks was the trainer of the New York Yankees. Oh, I got to think of his name. I'll think of it before while I'm talking to you here, like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe McCarthy left the Yankees and went to the Boston Red Sox. And I told him, your trainer, I said, you've won about 6 World Series with the Yankees. Now you're going to Boston, Joe McCarthy. I said, you'll never see another World Series ring. And he didn't like that, you know. And he didn't either. He didn't. But trainers are great, great guys. Like, I mean, and
they were team doctors, too. They had to be the team doctor at the time, yeah.
They did everything. Like, you know, I played with teams of trainers. Instead of the doctors, they would even stitch you, like, you know. Oh, yeah. I played with trainers. They were better stitchers than doctors. They did everything, believe me. They had a tough job.
They got to know the players very well, too. One guy wanted his stick taped up and his skate sharpened and all the little superstitions in the locker room.
Oh, yeah. Eddie Frolik was a trainer of the New York Yankees for about 18 years. And then he was also, in the wintertime, he was a trainer of the Chicago Blackhawks, Eddie Frolik. And Joe McCarthy left the Yankees to go to the Red Sox, and he went with him. I said, Eddie, because, you know, that's how I made my living in the summer in baseball. I mean, I played baseball. I was paid to play baseball. I was a playing manager starting at 24 years old. I won 7 championships in 10 years, and it's because of what I did in baseball that when I retired, there were 6 teams in the National League, and 3 of them offered me jobs, because I had everybody play for me. I had Canadians, Americans, Puerto Ricans, Cubans, Blacks. I always had 8-9 black players. I was the first guy to bring black players into Canada to play in we call the Canadian-American League. So I was really involved in baseball, too. Like, you know, I loved it. I mean, I was so lucky that I was able to do what I wanted all my life, baseball in the summer and hockey in the winter.
Oh, that's great. Hey, I just recently spoke to Mike McMahon. He was with the Rangers back in up to about 66.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was, and he played junior hockey for me. He played with Jean Rattel and Rod Gilbert and Mike McMahon. We had a great team in Guelph. I was lucky when I retired, and I could have gone to Chicago, Detroit, or New York, and I chose New York, and they said, well, we'd like you to coach a professional team, or we just bought a junior team in Guelph. I said, well, I played 15 years pro, and I just as soon go to work with the junior team. You know, guys are 18, 19, 20 years old. They said, okay, we'll send you to Guelph. We just bought the team. So I went there. I became the manager and the coach, and I inherited Mike McMahon, John Rattel, Rod Gilbert, and we ended up in first place. Now we beat out Niagara Falls, which is Boston's junior team, and we had to play Toronto St. Mike's, which in Canada is the same as Notre Dame. Every priest in Canada was a scout for St. Michael's.
That's right.
And they were sponsored. Yeah, they were sponsored club of Toronto Maple Leafs. So we meet in the finals. Well, before we start the first game, they had a big luncheon in Guelph for us. And Guelph was a town of about 40,000 people. So there were like 300 people at the luncheon. The luncheon's all over, and the guy comes up, and he says, "Hey," he says, "I'm really worried." I said, "Worry about what?" He says, "I know we have a good team. I know you end up in first place, but you've got to play St. Michael's." Yeah. Well, he says, "You know, they're all Catholic boys." He says, "They go to Mass every morning and light all those candles, and now you're going to have to play them in the finals." I said, "Don't worry about it." I said, "I got a key to the same church, and when they're lighting those candles, I'll be right behind them blowing them out." A lot of fun. Jerry Cheevers, who went on to become a great goalkeeper of the Bruins, he was a goalkeeper for them, and guess what? They beat us out in 7 games because of him. That guy was a money goalkeeper from the time he played junior hockey, and he beat our team out, and we were better than him, but we lost Gilbert, Rob Gilbert. We lost him when he went into the boards and broke his back, and we lost a key guy like that. But Jerry Cheevers, I'll never forget that. He played great in the playoffs against us, and he played great in the playoffs every year for the Bruins.
Mm-hmm. And Toronto let him go. They didn't protect him. They didn't protect him, and he went to Boston. They kept the old guys instead.
That's exactly. They kept Johnny Barr and Terry Souchik. You got that right.
Mm-hmm.
And they should have kept him, I'll tell you.
Were you tempted to keep Mike McMahon, or at the time were you getting some younger defensemen coming up?
No. I mean, you know, we had a real good farm system. We had all these young guys coming, and in those days we had a draft, and you could only protect 18 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
And we always had a protection problem, like, you know. And we didn't, you know, we had too many players that we couldn't protect, and we lost them in the draft because we went into expansion. We lost them. He was a good defenseman, too.
Yeah,
really
I spoke to Cesar Maniago, and many people might not even remember Mike, but Cesar said he was one of the best defensemen ever play in front of him.
Plus he was a left-hand defenseman. He played like Bobby Orr. He played on the right side, and he was very good on the power play. Could really handle a puck good. And his dad had played he was a pro, too. His dad was Mike McMahon.
Mm-hmm.
Same as him. He was a real good player.
Just one more question for me. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention John Halligan, his recent passing. Great man. So friendly. How about a couple of thoughts about him?
Oh, I'll tell you. I came home last Thursday, and there was a call from Janet Halligan, his wife, to my wife. I walked in my office. There's a message here from Janet Halligan. John Halligan died. Mm. I talked to John Halligan at least 2-3 times a week, every week since I left the New York Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
When I took over the Rangers, I mean, they had, you know, their history for 20 years was bad. And everything was bad. I mean, their records keeping was bad. The PR dependent was bad. And I hired John Halligan. About 3 weeks later, he came in to me. He said, "I have to hire an assistant. I'd like you to meet her and give your approval." I said, "Fine. Send your assistant in." And it was a girl. And the girl was Janet Halligan, who became his wife a year or so later.
Mm-hmm.
And between those two people, I ran teams in the National Hockey League for 30 years. I've never had two people more dependable, more skilled, who worked more loyal to the organization than Janet Halligan and John Halligan. John Halligan was the custodian of the Rangers' history. He was the finest person you ever want to meet. I mean, I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. And I'm still shocked, believe me.
Yep.
And, you know, they had no children. And John Halligan had no brothers or sisters, and both parents are dead. Janet Halligan has a brother, and that's all. So I really feel bad for her, like, you know, because, I mean, they were together all those years, like, you know.
Yeah, and they were
John Halligan was...
Yeah, they were to point people on for the media. They would, like, when that big Park trade would go down, they were there, and they faced the media. So they were a very integral part of the team.
Oh, absolutely. Like, you know, and like I said, they're two of the most loyal people, the hardest working people that you ever want to be associated with. I'm really going to miss him. You know, he's written all, and he brought everyone up to date in the Rangers. And he called me 2-3 times a week because he knew. I knew everybody going back to Lester Patrick. And of course, he'd send me all this, and he'd write all these different stories and send them to me to confirm, like, you know, and he'd send pictures of players he'd never seen before, and who's this guy and who's that guy, like, you know.
Mm.
2 days before he died, we talked, and he was writing another book, and he had a player on there he didn't know who it was, and he sent to me, he says, I think this is Tony Leswick. And I call him right back. I said, no, that's not Tony Leswick. He said, well, it has to be because the picture was taken in 1950. I said, well, that's just the year the Rangers went to the Stanley Cup Finals. Let me look at that a little while. And, you know, it was sort of blocked out. So I looked at it, and I looked at it, I called him back. I said, I got who it is, John. Who is it? This is 2 days before he died. I said, Reggie Sinclair. He said, it can be. He said, he wasn't here. I said, he was there, John. You check your records there. Call back. He says, you're right. And that's who it was. That's the last time I touched him. Reggie Sinclair. Yeah. And they got to the finals against Detroit in 1551. They traded him to Detroit, like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But John was a great guy. And I'll tell you, I'm going to make a recommendation to the New York Rangers. I think that what they should do at Madison Square Garden, they should name that press room the John Halligan Press Room.
Right.
Exactly. Recognition. And that's what I'm going to do.
That's a great idea.
That's a very good
really
idea.
Yeah.
And I'm sad, too, because he told me that he was thinking of maybe finally convincing you to do a book, and he wanted to work with you. But
He did, yeah.
Yeah, that's
he
the last conversation we had.
Yeah, that's right. You're right. And, you know, I'd always say to him, and, you know, every time I talk to him, like I said, it's at least two, three times a week, he says, how you feeling? I said, I feel good. What about you? Oh, I feel good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, how are you busy? He says, I'm busier than a cat on a hot tin roof. I'll never forget him. Oh, I'm going to miss him. But I'm really going to miss
man.
Him.
Well, Jim, thanks. I don't want to tie up the line. You might have a couple other callers coming in, but appreciate you letting me speak to Mr. Francis. Great,
real nice
great
talking.
Stories.
You did a great job in your book, believe me. And I mean,
thanks.
You know, everything I, all the different quotes and things I said, there wasn't one thing out of order. You were absolutely right on.
Oh, nice great,
job.
Thank you.
Jay,
hang around,
Jay, thanks for
Jay
calling
Frank.
In. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
You know, Emil, you couldn't have said it better about, again, I think a lot of us Ranger fans were so shocked when we heard John Halligan. We had him on show, I guess, a month before his passing. And and I put it, and it's so great that you said it, because I said, if there's a Ranger historian out there, it's him.
Yep.
Before I had him
that's
on.
Right.
And I was pleased as punch to have him on, and we said, oh, we'll get back to you, and I can't wait to hear more, and then this happened. Can you tell the fans out there, I mean, it was a total shock. Can you tell the fans, I know you did it when you were talking to Jay, but just how, like what, in a day in the life of a John Halligan when he was working for you, what would he do? What did his job entail?
Oh, God, everything. Like, you know, I mean, first of all, he's got to put the program together. Then he's got to put the yearbook together, you know, and that takes all summer. And then he's got to write all the bios. He's got to be there like, you know, you're making all the trades. He's got to put all the press releases out, and he comes in like, every press release, he comes in, and you have to approve it. Like, you know, I mean, you work closer. I work closer than anybody else in the Ranger organization, because everyone I'm doing, he's got to know what I'm doing and all the trades. He's got to be the first guy that he's got to know, and he's got to put the press release out, like, you know. So he's on call all the time, 24 hours a day. And that's the way I work. Like, you know, hell, I made trades at 2 o'clock in the morning, like, you know, and first guy I got to get a hold of is him, like, you know. But, he's your right hand. He was my right-hand guy, believe me. He was with me all the time, like, you know. And then what would happen in New York was, when I was there, there was about 7 different daily papers. Now there's probably about 3, like, you know. And they kept sending in guys that, they signed the hockey. They knew nothing about hockey. So John would have to bring him in and introduce you, and then you'd have to coach him along. You have to bring him along, like, you know, and because now you needed the publicity. You need them, like, you know, in their papers to help, you know, build what you're trying to build in New York, like, you know. And John had to work with all those guys, and I'll tell you, a couple of times when I first took over the Rangers in 1963, we used to travel out by train. And unfortunately, there's a couple of writers we lost, like, you know, going between Chicago and New York, and John even had to write these stories for him. Like, he covered up for him, I'll tell you. He was a great guy, and all the writers loved him, like, you know, which by them liking him helped me, like, you know, because they figured, you know, maybe I wasn't such a bad guy after all. Well, he helped me a lot, John.
Because, you know, they had that NHL live show on, and even, like, up to, you know, his passing, he was calling in, and if there was a range of fact that they had gotten wrong or didn't know about, he would call in. I mean, what a guy. I mean, you and him, I consider that you guys are the face of the franchise as far as I'm concerned.
You guys were there in the
humble beginnings of this.
We were there when there were nothing. I mean, when I took over the Rangers, they were averaging 7,800 people a game in the old garden. And there was 3,000 season ticket holders. That's the way it was. And they had been in the playoffs once in 10 years. Then, fortunately, we had the Rattels, and we had the Gilberts, and we had the Brad Parks, and Kachuks, and Fairbairns. And one of the best important deals I made, I got Eddie Jochman. I had to give up four players to get him. But we built that team, like, you know. When we moved in 68 to the new Madison Square Garden, we never had anything less than a sellout from that time on. Of course, we were selling out the old garden 2 years before that. You know, but that's how that franchise was built up. And John was an intricate part of the whole thing, believe me. He really was.
And his wife, can you tell the fans out there what his wife did? It sounds like they were soulmates to me. I mean, they were just... you know, they were just a perfect match. Can you give us what they did for the Rangers and maybe a little bit peek into their personal life? Were they soulmates? Because it sounds like a great story.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, John brought her in to introduce her to me so that I would meet her, like, you know, and then approve him hiring her. And he brought her in as his assistant in the PR department. And between the two of them, they would have kids come in and work during the summer, you know, putting all the records together. But they worked as a team, the two of them, like, you know. And she was into it just like John was. I mean, they were so involved and so part of the New York Rangers, it wasn't funny. I mean, that was their life, like, you know. I mean, they didn't have any children, so the Rangers were like their baby. And they worked right around the clock, you know, working for the Rangers. And then she was a great gal and still is. And the last 2-3 years, she got into real estate. And she was doing really good in real estate, too, until, of course, the little depression
we've
had.
Yeah.
You know? But she has a great personality. And, I mean, all the visiting press and all the people coming, they knew them both, like, you know. They knew them both so well because they knew that whatever they needed, they're going to get it from Janet and John, like, you know.
I think it's a great idea. About naming the press room the John Halligan Memorial Press, and what's just the John Halligan Room or what have you.
Yep.
And Amy, I'm going to say something here. You know, you've been on the show twice, and I love you. Jim loves you. How come there's no Amy Kett banner raised up at Madison Square Garden? There's a lot of us fans are starting a little grassroots movement here to get you up there. I mean, come on. You were the franchise. what's standing in the way? I mean, really? I mean,
maybe they put up that award a couple of years ago, like, you know, the Emil Francis Award to the coach who has did most for amateur hockey. Like, you know, maybe that's I don't know what they do, and I'd never question them because that's their business. You know, I'm not going to promote myself. I'll tell you something. You know, I know I won more games as coach of the New York Rangers than anybody in history. I'm going to say one thing. I don't think anybody will break that record because I don't think anybody will last that long in New York.
That's right. Well, I know the fans.
They do a hats off to them.
I know the fans are looking. I mean, come on. It took long enough for, Eddie Mathew to get up there too. And
those
Harry
guys
should
have been up there. They should have been the first ones up there.
Exactly.
I know.
I mean, I don't
want to. No.
I mean, I don't want to say they're doing something backwards, donkey backwards.
No.
We got to, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Those two guys, they were so deserving. I'm so glad that they were recognized because they were two great players of the Rangers and real lean times, like, you know. They went through tough times, I'll tell you, with those teams. And, I mean, I played with both of them. I moved with Andy Bathgate for 2 years. I mean, He was such a great player, I'll tell you. And Harry Hall, you couldn't have had a more dedicated Ranger than that guy. Played more games than anybody in Ranger history. What were they waiting for? You know, I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. I want to ask. I got two quick questions, and since you're talking about Harry Howell, I want to ask Emil a question. Is it true that the fans, the Ranger fans, didn't take to Harry right away because he wasn't a physical defenseman?
Exactly. When I took over the Rangers, I remember in '63, and God, I used to flinch behind the bench, like, you know, because they would have, I could hear him. Of course, the team had been doing bad, like, you know, and I could hear these guys, one guy especially. Hit him with your purse, Harry. Oh, and I would stand behind that bench.
Emil, I yelled that at Michael Rosenthal.
And, you know, I mean, I went into the stands. I got sued for a million. I mean, I did everything that maybe you shouldn't have done. And I could hear this guy, hit him with your purse, Harry. And then he'd yell, Francis, you are my hero. And I said, oh, you know. But I said, hey, don't even listen to that guy. Well, here I am, you know. I love baseball, of course. I love the Yankees from the time I was 6 years old. The Yankees were always my team when there was Babe Ruth and Bill Dickey and, you know, Rizzo, all those guys, you know. Tony Lazzari said, anyway, I take my family. That's how I relaxed for a little bit in the summer. I went to a Met game. I'm at Shea Stadium. And I'm sitting there. And I got my two kids. One's about 10, one's 12, I guess, and my wife. And every time a Met player come up, like, and they were bad then, you know, Casey Stengel was a man.
Oh, yeah.
I said, oh, what the? I could hear the same voice, like, oh. So I didn't say a word, like, oh. I stood up, and my wife knew that there was trouble, because she knew me. She said, where are you going? What do you mean, where am I going? She said, you better sit down. You're going to get in trouble. I said, no, I got to go to the men's room. I wasn't going to the men's room at all, like that. I walked around the corner, and I looked up, and here he is. This guy was so big, he took up two seats. He must have weighed 300 pounds, like, you know. And he had all these little signs and all these sayings, like, you know. And each Met player come up, he'd yell, like, and the people would laugh. And I stood there, and I looked, and I said, go sit down. Don't get yourself in trouble over crap like that. I went back and sat down. And if I hadn't, I'd probably gone up in the stands because, you know, this guy was just a joker, you know? But that's how he got his kicks, picking on the players, you know? And me, you know, I mean, I could get in trouble very easily, believe me.
Yeah. We've heard the stories.
I was smart enough to go back
stories,
and sit down.
Emil. If we heard the calling the players, you hot dog, you donkey, we know all the
Yeah.
Now, the one other question I wanted to ask, and since we're talking about the Ranger fans and things like that, what was the team's relationship in those days, and the organization itself, the relationship with the fans? Because I tell you, Emil, nowadays Ranger fans in general feel there's kind of a disconnect between the fans and the organization. Like, it's, you know, they just don't feel, you know, they just don't feel a part of things like I think we used to.
Well, you know, the Rangers and Frank Boucher, when he was the general manager of the Rangers, was the guy that started the fan club. And God, when I was, our fan club was up to 2,000 people. And, you know,
wow.
They would have their dinners and players had to, they go, they'd have monthly meetings, the players would go there. Then at the end of the season, they'd have a dance and a big dinner. And, I mean, I'll tell you, it was very close. Like, I mean, we had 2,000 people in the Ranger fan club. And that was Frank Boucher, like, you know, who started that whole thing. And they were really good. I mean, they were really got loyal Ranger fans. They'd take bus trips to Montreal. And, you know, the Rangers weren't doing good then, but they were really loyal people, like, you know. Oh, God, the Ranger fan club was the biggest in the National League for a long time. I don't know what it is now, of course, but they sure were for a long time, I'll tell you.
Well, see, the Ranger fan club is still around, Emil, but now the organization, they want you to join their own fan club and spend a lot of money to be a part of it.
Oh, I know. They can't have the Ranger golf tournament. You know, I mean, yeah, it's going to cost money to be, And in those days,
I don't have that kind of...
Yeah.
I belong to the Ranger fan club. It costs me $15 a year.
Yeah, really.
I get the card, and I love it. I don't need no big fancy thing. I'm a card-carrying member. You know?
Yeah, good for you. And I'll tell you, I never missed a Ranger Fan Club meeting, and I was always a guest speaker. And I told the players, you're there or else. They were all there at the windup, and they give their awards. Are you kidding? Because they were great people. They were really loyal Ranger fans, boy.
Yeah, well, see, that's great. And then we appreciate you coming on with us and talking to our fans tonight. It's great that you do that. And I think.
Well, I'll tell you. I've got a Ranger logo on my behind, and it'll be there forever. I mean, that was the best years of my life in New York. Best years of my life.
Amiel, we love having you on the show, and, you know, I try to go especially, well, actually me and Jim, we go out of our way. We like to surprise you. Last time we surprised you with Shields Villemure.
Yep,
Jim,
you sure did.
I'm going to surprise you. I'm not going to tell you who it is. Maybe, Jim, if you put the man on the line. Maybe
all
we'll
right.
see if Emil can recognize the voice. If not, then I'll give him some hints.
Good.
Hey,
all right,
hey.
Let's bring in from the 212-355. You are on Blue Shirt Banner Radio with Jim and Eddie and Emil Francis. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. It's only been about 25 years since I've spoken to you, Emil. But I wonder if you remember me asking you a question after a game. You were bragging about how you were making these Rangers into a lot of tough guys, and you told the writers, well, yeah, you know, we had 26 hits tonight. We really had a lot of hits. And the next game, you guys lost, and I said, how many hits, Emil? He said, I don't keep track of them. And
we only kept track when we wanted to keep track of them. Yeah, right.
Well, Emil, I got to tell you, you did give me an education. It's should I tell them who it is, fellas?
Yeah, tell them. Go ahead.
Oh, Emil, it's Jerry Eskenazi.
Oh, Jerry! Oh, God Almighty! We haven't talked for so long, like, you know. God, yeah, well, that's great. And you know, I'll tell you, Jerry, the thing that I started in New York, they do now in the National League. I kept face-offs, hits, giveaways, and I had Dennis Ball. I've got to tell you a quick story here. Boston beat us out for the Stanley Cup. The next year, like it all, we finished on a Sunday night, and we started the first game in Boston on Thursday. And I had a charter. We flew right out to a little town about 70 miles outside of Boston, and we stayed there. And we practiced in the morning. We practiced in the afternoon. Then we looked at film, and then we all ate together, and we did that right up through Thursday morning before we went into New York. And here's what I did. I had it down that we had to have 40 hits to win. We had to have 40 hits. And that doesn't mean knocking a guy down, but it means moving him off the puck. And if you get 40 hits, it's funny how it works out. You end up with anywhere from 35 to 40 shots, because by taking him off the puck, you're going to have the puck as much as him. You can't have more than 16 giveaways. You don't want to give away the puck in your end because you're giving them a chance to score. You don't want to give away in their end because you're taking away a scoring chance, and you had to win 70% of the faceoffs. And I had Dennis Ball. You know, and Dennis Ball, like, you know, maybe didn't have the best eyesight in the world. So we go into Boston. I had all my charts made out, and I had Dennis keep the charts. Well, we go into Boston, and we beat him 4-1 the first game. And after, Dennis comes in, and he posts a chart on there. I give him $5 a hit. Guess what? We had 78 hits. And the players are yelling at Dennis, you blind so-and-so, you have me down for 5 hits. They're arguing with Dennis over $5 because he took 2 hits away from these sets. All right? So we won that game. Now the next game, we're in Boston again. This time, Ron Harris hit Esposito 5 minutes into the game. And guess what? We never seen Esposito again. They took him away in the stretcher and took him to the hospital. So after the game, we get on the bus, and we're going to fly back to New York. And from the back of the bus came a big yell, Simkowski. Hey, Kath, what about that hit Harry put on Esposito? Do you think that's worth $5? I said, I think we'll give him 100. And we beat him out in 5 games, including 3 right in Boston.
Well, you know, Abel, that's the kind of story that we used to love, the writers used to love talking to you about. And, you know, I heard you talking before about how when you took over the franchise, about the attendance and everything else.
Yeah,
I don't know
if the
listeners realize this, but the very first hockey game I ever wrote about, I saw. It was, I had never seen a game before, and this is what the New York Times, and I guess a lot of the newspapers in New York, Emil, thought about hockey. I was sitting in the office at noon. The National Hockey League season was opening. You guys were opening in Boston. It might have been 1964 or 65. I don't remember. Columbus Day, Columbus weekend.
Yeah.
And we didn't have any reporter assigned to the opening of the Ranger season. That day at 12 o'clock, what's that? At 12 o'clock, they said to me, catch a flight to Boston. And I flew to Boston. We didn't have the shuttle then. And I flew to Boston. I was reading the World Telegram and Sun and the afternoon papers because I didn't know anything about the game. I got to the press box. John Halligan was there. John Halligan explained to me what a face-off was. He explained to me what an offside was. And I don't know if you remember the game, Emil, but you beat Boston badly. You scored 7 or 8 goals in the opening game of the season.
No, I don't remember that.
Yeah, it was a very unusual game because, as you know, in those days, the average score was something like 3-2. You guys scored 7 or 8 goals. You had a lot of fights. Reggie the Ruffian Fleming on the Bruins had some fights with the Rangers. And the next day, the sports editor said to me, boy, everyone's talking about your story. He said, why? It turns out I used an adjective. No one ever used a description before to cover hockey in the New York Times. Then they made me the hockey writer. And you made me the smart guy.
That's great.
Or maybe you created a Frankenstein monster. I don't know, Emil.
No, I'll tell you, we had a lot of fun together. And I'll never forget that time when you were with us. Remember that bus driver left us there at the bridge?
Oh, yeah. Unbelievable.
Tell us about that.
Oh, God. Yeah, we got snowed out. We had to get to Montreal. And I was last in the bus. So all the team got on the bus, and writers got on the bus, and I was the last one to get on. I look, and sitting in the seat, here's a girl there. So I called the bus driver off. I said, what's that girl doing on there? Oh, he said, that's my wife. I said, well, where do you intend on taking her? He says, I'm taking her to Montreal for the weekend. It's not in that bus, you're not. So he said, can I take her with me? I'll go down to the tunnel there, like Midtown Tunnel, and I'll drop her off and she can go home. I said, okay. So we go down to a street just ahead of Midtown Tunnel. He pulls up like her, he gets off, he says to her, he says, get your bag. And she gets a bag, and they both leave like her. So we sit there for about 15, 20 minutes. She doesn't come back. So I get off, I start walking around. There's a bar there. So I walk in the bar because I'm going to call the bus company. And the guys, the bar was full. And they recognized me. Hey, Cud, what are you doing here? I said, I'm looking for a bus driver. The guy behind the bar says, he came in here with a girl, and they called the cab, and he left. I said, really? The guy took off. He left us there all by ourselves. Jesus. Do you remember that, Jerry?
Oh, sure. I was sitting right behind you, and the New York Rangers was stranded somewhere in a city. The bus driver left to go with his girlfriend because you didn't want his girlfriend along.
That's right.
Wow.
And so now we got to Montreal at 5 o'clock in the morning. We had snow all the way, so we pull in front of the hotel in Montreal. The driver came on. He had a carton of cigarettes. He put his big gloves on. He put his dart. He says, okay, so let's go. We got to move. And I kept saying, move this bus. Move this. He said, they got the thing on here. I can't go any faster. We got there at 5 in the morning. Everybody gets off the bus. He said, I've been told to stay and wait for you tomorrow night in case I have to take you back. I says, turn this bus around. Go right back to New York. We'll walk back before we get back in that bus. And sure as old hell, we got snowed out again, but I got a bus coming from Montreal, and we went back with there. That guy didn't get over 40 miles an hour the whole way.
Well, I guess...
That was a long trip.
You took the bus. I guess there was an Air Canada strike or something. Was that or snow
that's
or
right.
something?
That's right. That's
well,
right. And
well, you know...
a big story.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was
a
very, very big story about the... I called it the wayward bus driver.
That's right. So guess what happened? I called the company when I got back. I was so pissed off of them, And you know what they told me? The guy didn't even come back to pick up his check. His wife probably shot him. I wonder what happened to that guy.
Yeah, I guess what happened is that in a newspaper, I think I didn't write that it was his wife. I wrote he went with his girlfriend, and
that's
he was very
he was.
Upset. By the way, Emil, you know, you had some interesting travel stories in your time. Do you remember, you know, that day that I took that I covered the Rangers for the very first time up in Boston, you
yeah.
guys, you know what they used to do now? I know that they didn't pay big bucks in those days, Emil, but the Rangers actually slept in the train at night on the siding in Boston,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, that's
rather
right.
rather than go to a hotel room for the night after the game,
yeah.
and they didn't have a charter
yeah.
flight, they slept in
yeah.
a train on the side of the railroad
yeah.
siding, and then in the
yeah.
morning they
that's
got
right.
up and they got in about what, 7 a.m. or something like that.
That's right. That's exactly. That's what they used to do. We used to travel by train. You got it. That's right. A lot of fun, I'll tell you. But there were days you'll never forget, and people would never forget, including yourself, like
that. Oh, it was a one, and you know, and Emil, you and I guess I, to some extent also, we were there at a time when there was a transition between the 16 league and
yeah.
the future, and
yeah,
so we
yeah.
had the way hockey was played for 50 years, and
yeah.
and the attitudes, the salaries,
yeah.
the way
yeah.
of life.
The
way players approach the game, the way coaches
right.
were in charge, before
yeah.
they were agents in between, and before you had to go to arbitration if you could sue a guy, if you could fine a guy for being late, you know, until the whole thing just changed, the world turned topsy turvy.
Oh, absolutely! I remember I took Gilbert to arbitration. I had to go to Montreal to meet before the arbitrator, and guess who owned Oakland Seals, he bought the team of Charlie Finley. I had to wait. Charlie Finley had taken 14 guys to arbitration. I was there. I waited 6 o'clock at night before I got in with Gilbert. He had 14 guys in arbitration. Finley. He was doing it all himself,
wow.
like, you know. Crazy business.
Yeah. Well, you know, how many guys were lucky enough like I was? Do you remember a guy named Lefty Reed? Lefty Reed was
yeah.
the curator.
Hall
well,
of Fame.
Well, yeah, he was the curator of the Hall of Fame,
sure.
and
yep.
they and the Hall of Fame, of course, was in Toronto at the old CNE, the Canadian
yeah.
Exposition
right.
grounds. And what yeah. he used to do is, if one team had won, say, 3 games in the Stanley Cup, he would then
yeah.
bring the cup to the next city, wherever the next game
yeah,
was going to be, in
sure.
anticipation of presenting it. However, he didn't like to fly because he thought that in case something happened to the Stanley Cup, you know, in case a plane something, the cup
okay.
would be lost. So he used to drive everywhere. Now, in a 6-team
okay.
league, you could do that. So I thought,
yeah.
gee, it would be fun to drive with this guy with the Stanley Cup. So we're
yeah.
going... We're going across Windsor, Ontario, I think, and I think maybe
yeah.
it was either Red Wings. I guess
yeah,
it was the Red Wings.
The border there.
And so we go across the border, and the guy says, "Would you open up your trunk, please?" So he opens up the trunk, and he sees this big box in there. The guy says, "What do you got in there?" He says, "The Stanley Cup." He says, "The what? Let me see it." You know, and
he
sure enough, he
stole it.
You know, sure enough, he had the Stanley Cup in it. And I remember he showed me all these cheap diners he used to eat all the way up in Ontario because they would give him like $12 a day for meal money.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, right.
So he would make it stretch, you know.
I didn't know you did that.
What's that?
That's great.
Yeah.
I didn't know you did that. That's great.
Yeah, oh, it was a wonderful experience, Abel. And,
yeah,
you know, just
yeah.
the idea of and he was like a kid with a toy with the Stanley Cup there. But
yeah.
when the guy said,
oh.
"What do you got in the back there? Let me see it," you know. And he was keen. And hockey players, as you know, are very superstitious. In fact, they're probably the most
yeah.
superstitious players I've ever come across.
Probably.
And
probably.
He wouldn't let them see the cup beforehand. He would hide it somewhere. He would hide
oh,
it in
God.
The bowels of the place, you know, somewhere. And
they didn't want to see it. They figured to put a hex on them.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. Hockey was, in many ways, it was a sport that not only went back to the turn of the century, but it was the most exciting sport to write about because it's the one sport in which every fan there is there because he wants to be there. He's passionate,
yeah, right.
you know. He's not there
yeah.
because his boss gave him tickets, you know, or
right,
the company
right.
bought tickets. The hockey fan
yeah.
is the most passionate fan, and you're in the
yeah.
small arena, you know, especially up in Canada, Emil, like up in
oh,
the,
yeah.
like when we used to practice in Kitchener.
Oh, sure.
You go to these 7,000, 6,000
yeah.
seat arenas and the noise
sure.
that they make.
Yeah.
And, oh, it was a wonderful yeah. experience.
Sure, remember we'd train in Kitchener and Boston, we'd train in London, and we'd go play one another. Geez, it'd be like, you know, and those. You know, that's the only chance they got to see those teams play, like, you know. They
oh,
attacked
sure.
those buildings, like, you know. Yeah, because Oh, it's like a religion, like, you know, it's like a religion, really.
Well, you know, at one point I had gotten so fascinated with hockey, I did a lot of studies of it, and I used to speak to Ken Dryden a lot about it. And Canada actually formed a commission to determine the impact that hockey had on its way of life. I don't think any country in the world was as tied up with one sport as Canada is with hockey. I don't know whether it still is, Emil. I don't know whether it still is, but it certainly was when you were a kid.
It still is. I mean, they packed those buildings. They're selling out every game.
Oh yeah.
Canada. And their TV ratings go right through the roof, like, you know. I mean,
Hockey Night in Canada was the top rated show. Hockey Night in Canada. Yeah.
They'd never miss that. Exactly. Yeah. You're right. Absolutely. And then when you left hockey, you started covering the New York Jets, right?
Yes. And after the Rangers, I covered the Jets from 75 to 90, and then I got time off for good behavior for a few years, and then when Bill Parcells took over, I covered them again until I retired.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you something, Emil, and I'm not saying it just because you're on the air with me, but I do a lot of lecturing on cruise ships, and I do a lot of talking.
Yeah.
And
good for you.
The two most fascinating people I've met in my sports writing career were you and Bill Parcells. And a couple of the things that you had in common was that you would never settle for anything less than what you thought was the right thing. And other words, I don't think you ever compromised on your standards. You know, and I think when
probably
the Rangers wanted, you know, and when management wanted you to compromise, you said no. You know, and
that's exactly right.
And I thought that was another standard that I have is that wherever you went and wherever Bill went, you made winners, you know, when you created, you know, you turned around franchises,
and that's
an impossible thing to do.
Now, Jerry, I just want to jump in. I love hearing the banter going back and forth. Me and Jim are typing here, we're smiling ear to ear, enjoying the stories. But Jerry, can you tell the fans out there? Perhaps how we know you got started with that Boston story, and we actually looked it up on the internet, and we had the box score, and me and Jim were laughing because you were right, your recollection
dead
was
on.
Right on, dead on, and
right down to that it was Columbus Day,
exactly
a 6-2 Ranger win.
Wow,
Ranger win. I'll give you the goal score is here. Let's hear the goal scores. It's Don Marshall, right? Don Marshall, that was his first.
Yeah,
name,
Donnie
right?
Marshall played with played on a line with Phil Goyette and Bob Nevin.
That's right. And in this game, he got an even strength goal from Camille Henry and Rod Gilbert.
Yeah.
Then Green scored for Boston. Is that Teddy Green?
Terrible Teddy Green.
Yeah, Teddy Green. Teddy Green.
Then Hatfield from Brown and Richardson. Arnie Brown? Could that have been Arnie Brown?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, that's Arnie Brown.
Richardson, yeah. I don't know. Who was he?
He was the guy who was up for a cup of coffee. He played for our sponsor club out of Winnipeg. He was a left winger.
And Bobby Nevin scored from Howard Howell.
Yeah.
Number 8.
Dick Duff.
Yeah.
Then Shock for Boston.
Yeah.
And
Shock,
Camille Henry.
And what was the crowd? What was the crowd? 13,909, I'll bet. Something like that, right? In the
garden. I'm going to give you...
Probably you're right.
You're right.
Camille Henry played
13,909. Can't believe
good, very good. Yeah, Camille Henry played on a line with Jean Rattel.
What
were
their names, Jerry?
Camille Henry played with Rattel and Gilbert at that time.
You know, Emil, I don't know if you knew that up in that Boston press box, we were sitting like 6 inches in front of fans. Well, fans. Well, there was a woman behind us. Actually, she's a young girl, it's about 19 or 20, and she used to curse and yell and call you guys, you know, cement head and you know, losers and, you know, New York stiffs and all this kind of stuff. So you remember Dana Mosley from the Daily News?
So
Dana Mosley turns to me and he whispers, except that he whispered sort of loud. He says to me, "How would you like to bring her home to mother?" So she heard it. She says, "I don't think you had a mother, you New York jerk."
Oh, they were tough. Oh God, that's funny.
I tell you,
that
listen, there's still, you know, and nowadays the women are as vocal as the men, and I love it. I mean, you know, they're as passionate about the game as the guys are.
Yeah.
in a lot of cases,
yeah.
they know more than the guys do. You know, the guys are all, you know, they get with the guys, let's all go out. These girls come to the games, and we meet Ranger fans, just so passionate about the game. And, Jerry, can you tell us how a press conference would go with Emil back in the day? Would you ask some questions? Or John Halligan would be the conduit? How did it work back then?
Well, actually, Emil was pretty good. He didn't need any help, although John was a terrific PR guy. And as Emil pointed out, I was listening to the show before I went on, he was extremely helpful and extremely knowledgeable. But after the game, Emil would make the points that he wanted to make. For example, when he created the statistic of hits, and I know you didn't make it up, Emil, because that was a very interesting thing. In fact, now it comes to me that I remember it was something like 40 or 45 hits in the game.
Right.
Emil ran a press conference almost like he ran a practice. He wanted to make something happen. He wanted the team to learn something. And so in the press, he wanted either us to appreciate something the team had done, or maybe, and you tell me if I'm wrong, Emil, but I had the feeling that in you saying something, you thought that you could get through to your players as well, or try to make the point of something. And he really started from such a small baseline. I mean, the Rangers were in a one team hockey town then. The Rangers were number two. I mean, they just didn't have the fan base, and they didn't have the attention of the newspapers. But Emil answered every question, sometimes impatiently, sometimes he would snap, but he would give you very, very thoughtful answers. If you asked Emil a technical question, he would stop everything and explain to you why something happened. He also was the first guy. I mean, statistics became computerized when the WHA came along. You know, the National Hockey League, for example, didn't provide plus minus figures. They would not provide them. No, they did not provide them to the public. They would give them to the teams, as Emil knows, but they would not provide them to the public. But Emil had, I swear without even looking, he must have had these things written on his sleeve or something. He came up with statistics every game that was just quite extraordinary. I think we all respected the cat. We enjoyed the give and take. And one of the things I liked about Emil, too, was that Emil was a great baseball fan. I guess he told you he was a Yankee fan, right? And so we enjoyed, but Emil loved talking the history of hockey. And for a guy like me who grew up on the sidewalks of Brooklyn, I never even knew anyone that ice skated. I mean, ice skating was something that they did up north, you know, and or certainly north of Brooklyn. But the post game press conferences, Emil was quoted more than the players. Hockey players were generally not a talkative bunch of guys in those days. After the games were over, Emil was right there, win or lose. He was right at the front of the locker room, in the little room off by himself. And you would just start the questions. John wouldn't interrupt him. John Halligan didn't interrupt him. Emil was the guy that he would make a statement. First, he'd make a statement about what happened in the game, and then each of us would ask questions. And like I say, if he wanted to make, like for example, say he was trying to, when Emil was trying to upgrade the image of the Rangers and, you know, bringing in players such as, you know, classy players such as Tim Horton and that kind of guy, if the guy did well in a game, Emil would make a point of it. You know, if Emil needed some beef, and I guess you remember, Emil, that was one of your problems you had with the team. You didn't have enough beef, and you didn't have enough guys that would hit, you know. As soon as that guy came up, you know, you'd be talking about him. You'd be talking about right-handed defensemen. You'd be talking about guys that could,
memory.
Yeah, things that we never thought about, things that the average person never thought about. And I think that what happened is that by making the writer smarter, Emil made New York's hockey fans smarter. And You know, I mean, the Jersey Devils and the New York Islanders did not invent hockey. You know, I mean, for many New Yorkers, it was invented. You know, it was invented in the bowels of Madison Square Garden. You know, Emil was the guy that made sure the circus didn't interrupt. Didn't you play game in Toronto or something once? I mean, a Stanley Cup game.
Yeah, I mean, like, I was called up from the minor leagues in 1950, and the first round, the Rangers had to play Montreal. They played the first two games in New York. And after that, we went to Montreal, and we played three games in Montreal, and Chuck Rayner was a goalkeeper. I was a backup. And Rayner played great, and the Rangers beat out the Canadiens. Now, we went to Toronto because we had no ice. The circus was in Madison Square Garden. So we went to Toronto, and we had a seven-game series with Detroit. It went to the seventh game before Detroit scored an overtime to win the Stanley Cup. We played five games in Detroit and two in Toronto. Those are our two home games in Toronto. So I went off. We were on the road for a month. So, you know, I never forgot that. So when the time came and they offered me the job to take over the Rangers, I said, only on one condition. It's not fair to the fans. It's not fair to the players that should ever happen again. The only way I'll take over this team is that we get all the games that we are entitled to at home. Well, I remember Jennings said he had to talk to Irving Felt, and they came back the next day. They said, well, we've talked to the circus, and the only way they'll agree to us being able to play games at home is that you won't play till 9 o'clock at night. I said, I don't give a shit if we play at midnight. We want to play at home. Remember, we used to play those late games.
Oh, sure.
But we wanted those home games,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. You also, Emil, were responsible.
We never missed a home game.
You know, it's 40 years now, but to me, the most memorable sports event I was ever at until I covered the 1980 Olympics and when the U.S. team beat the Soviets in 1980.
Oh, yeah.
But, Emil, 1969, the last game of the season, the Rangers needed to not only defeat the Detroit Red Wings, they needed Montreal to score, and they also needed to wind up with more goals than Montreal if the teams were tied, right? Because in those days, the goals for was the deciding factor. Well, I don't know if luck or whatever would have it, but Detroit lost on Saturday night. They're coming into Madison Square Garden Detroit clinched the playoff spot on Saturday night, and on Sunday they're coming into Madison Square Garden. They were tired. They probably had celebrated on a plane. And Emil, the players told me that before the game, Emil went around to each player, and he said, "Fellas, strange things have happened in sports." Because like I said, the Rangers had to defeat the Detroit Red Wings. Montreal had to lose. You know, I mean, all sorts of crazy possibilities. The Canadians had made the playoffs, 22 straight years or something like that?
That's right.
And Emil said, "Fellas, this is one of those nights that strange things can happen." And then he went around to each player. He went around to each player. Is my memory right, Emil? And you said, "Do you think we can do it? And how many goals for you, Rod?" And Rod said, I'll give you two goals. How many goals for you, Vic? I'll give you a goal. You know, how about you, Ratty? You know, and that kind. And he went around, and they killed Detroit. I mean, killed them, 9-5 or something like that?
9-5.
9-5. I'm looking at it right here, April 5th, 1970.
The only reason they got five goals, I pulled Eddie Drachman out about halfway through the second, because by that time we had a five-goal lead, and it was going to be goals four.
Right.
So I knew with that lead I could pull the goalkeeper, get an extra guy out there, and get more goals, like, you know. What happened that night. Now Montreal have to play in Chicago. And here I am out there living on Long Beach. I couldn't even sit down. I was out there walking. I told my wife, "You tell me when somebody scores." Like, and they go in the third period, and Montreal are losing 2-1. And now Chicago scored to make it 3-1. And guess what? They pulled the goalkeeper. The game ended up, they got beat about 9-1.
Backfired.
Oh,
Montreal is losing in the first period and pulls their goalie. Because they didn't care if they lost at that point. All they needed to do was outscore, was get the goals for. Now, do you remember this, Emil? that at the I went to the New York Times that night, and we had some great old radio receivers. We tuned in. I had someone in our radio room tune in to the Montreal broadcast, and they broadcast it to Bill Jennings, who was the president of. I had the phone next to the speaker, and I think that Bill Jennings was listening to the broadcast. And also that night that you were reading General Patton's autobiography, as I remember.
That's right. I'd been reading that for the last month of the season.
He was reading.
You got that right. Well, you got a hell of a memory.
I read
that book every night.
Wait a second. There's got to be something wrong with me, Emil. Why would I even know that, for crying out loud?
God almighty. What
kind of life do I lead? But anyway, so Emil picks up the book when he finds out they win, and he flings the book across the room in joy. It was. I think the book was called Triumph and Tragedy, or Triumph and
Defeat.
Exactly.
That's right. That's
and this
right.
was by General George S. Patton, you know. And I remember you reading that book on a bus ride, Emil. You had that book there last month. It was like your Bible.
That's right. You got that right, Jerry. Oh, God,
that,
I can't believe that.
And guys, that to me was the greatest. Even though most people don't even remember it. That to me was the single greatest sports event I had ever been connected with to that point in my career, because it was so dramatic, and it showed me the amazing thing about sports, that as long as you have a statistical chance, you can. That's why when I see experts on television, oh, they're out of it, they lost three in a row, baloney. I don't believe it. Until, like Yogi says, right, it ain't over till it's over. If you still have a statistical chance, I mean, you rallied your guys, Emil. You guys were out of it. I mean, how are you going to stop the Montreal Canadiens, you know, with 22 straight Stanley Cup appearances, Detroit Red Wings a playoff team? You're bound for fifth place, right, you know, or out of the playoffs, and then you rally them.
Let me tell you something. That night at Madison Square Garden, the chairman of the Madison Square Garden, Bill Jennings, Ed Oast, none came to the game. None of them. Because they figured it was all over with. Oh, yeah. I didn't see any of those guys because they're all so embarrassed. I didn't see any one of them until the following Wednesday. By that time, we were working on getting ready because we had to open the playoffs on Thursday. Nobody came around. They were so embarrassed, because they didn't come. And we got in like that. Oh, yeah. I never forgot that either.
Emil, I'm a little down on Bill Jennings. Hey, listen, he's the one that got rid of our beloved cat, and I didn't like that. And well, actually,
it wasn't him.
It wasn't
it
him.
It wasn't him.
Actually,
it was.
But I last time you won, you said it was me. I said no. No one's gonna fire me. I'll leave. I'm out of here. That's what you.
No, it wasn't
that's how
him.
It went.
No,
oh,
no.
Okay.
It wasn't him at all. It was a guy. You know, they made the guy who replaced Irving Felt. He only lasted about a year there. I'll think of his name.
Cohn? Was it Cohn?
Oh, Alan Cohn.
Alan
Cohn. What happened, Alan Cohn, he called me. I brought in Stewart to take over as coach. Because we were at war with the WHA, and shit, I was doing everything, So it was Christmas night, he called me, and we were 5 points out of the last playoff spot. He said, I got some advice for you. He said, I want you to fire that guy you brought in here, and you go back and coach yourself. I said, I run this team now for about 12 years. I don't need any help. Thank you. And I hung up. The next day, I was chairman of the general managers committee, and I was in Montreal, and Bill Jennings called me 11 o'clock at night. He says, I guess you had a conversation with Alan Cohn last night. I said, yes, I did. He said, what happened? So I told him. He said, where are you going from here? I said, well, we play in St. Louis on Tuesday, so I'm flying out of Montreal tomorrow to go to St. Louis. He says, you've got to come back to New York because Cohn wants to meet you in room 200 at 2 o'clock. I knew. I had my chiefs go with me. I said, well, I hung up the phone. I said, that's it. Said, what do you mean, that's it? I said, they're going to fire me. I said, I'm going to listen to that guy, for Christ's sake. Who the hell is he to tell? He doesn't know a goddamn puck from a Sputnik. So I flew back to New York. I went up to room 200 at 2 o'clock and ring the bell, and who comes there is Jennings, Bill Jennings. And we worked close together all those years. And he had a drink in his hand, and the ice was going back and forth, tick, 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 so we went and sat down. I looked around, I said, where's Alan Cohn? Oh, he said, he got tied up. at an important meeting, he couldn't come. Fine. You know, I knew right then. I said, fine. He says, you have two choices. He said, you can either resign or, he says, you can get fired. I said, go ahead and fire me. He says, you're fired. So,
Bill said that? Bill said that to you?
Yeah, yeah. So Bill said, it'll take about 30 minutes to get a press release together to announce that you're being replaced. I said, I'll tell you what you do with that press release. You know where you can put it. And I kicked my briefcase, I said, see you later, and I left. And that was it.
That's right. You went on to build St. Louis and Hartford and those teams. And,
do you remember?
Let me tell you something else that happened. A year and a half later, they fired Cohen. And a month later, guess who called? It was them, Bill, not Bill. The guy who was in charge called me to see what I'd consider coming back to New York. I says, are you kidding? I says, I got fooled once, but you'll never fool me again. You're talking to the wrong guy. I enjoyed my stay in New York, but I said, thanks, but no thanks.
They did you wrong. That's
why. Do you remember the nickname that I helped make Alan Cohn famous for? When Alan Cohn took over as the head of Madison Square Garden, I interviewed him, and I said, I was talking to him about his plans for hockey and his plans for the garden and everything else. And he said, well, look, he said, if it's a question of a bottom line or winning a Stanley Cup, I'd rather have a good bottom line. That's a hell of a thing to say. Right. So that's a hell of a thing to say. I mean, can you imagine the owner of a team saying, I'd rather win money than win a championship? I'd rather have money. Well, anyway, I came back to the office and I told the editor, hey, listen, this is what the guy said, you know, Alan Cohn, the new president of the Garden. So he said, well, that's a hell of a quote. And we had a thing called quotation of the day. It was like the top quotation. 7 o'clock that night, Alan Cohn calls me. I had just written the story. We just made it the quotation of the day. The paper was going to press in about 2 hours. He calls me up and he said, Jerry, he says, you know, he said that thing I said about a bottom line and a Stanley Cup. He says, I wish you wouldn't use it. I said, I got to tell you, Alan, the cat's out of the bag. I said, I already told you. Well, the next day it appears, and as you remember, Emil, very well. It was in the Times, and everyone picked up on it, that if it was a question of a bottom line or a Stanley Cup, I'd rather have a good bottom line. He then became known as Bottom Line Cohn.
Bottom Line Cohn, that's right. Oh, I remember that vividly. Like, now I go to St. Louis for 8 years, then I end up in Hartford. So they were doing an interview with me, like, you know, and they naturally always brought up what happened to the Rangers, like, you know, and so I explained about Cohn, like, you know. And so I'll tell you something right now. And the insurance companies, five insurance companies owned the hockey team in the Hartford at the time. And they built the Civic Center where they played and what have you. So I said, I'd like to catch that guy crossing the street. I'd run right over his ass, like, you know. So he called the head of Aetna. Aetna, like, you know, owned 50% of the team. So he called the president of Aetna Insurance who hired me. And he said, will you tell that guy to shut up? He says he's going to run over me. And I would have, too, if I'd ever caught him, I'll tell you.
Jerry, were you covering the Rangers when Emil was fired?
I actually looked back over my clippings and I wrote everything except what he told Jennings he could do with the press release.
I didn't tell anybody that. I didn't want to embarrass Bill Jennings.
And I remember when I reread it the other day that story. I said that was pretty ballsy of Emil, you know, to tell the public that I was fired and I'm not gonna apologize for it, you know, or anything else, you know. But
Jerry,
I'm sorry. Go on.
I just wanted to ask you, what was the feeling amongst the press as well as the fans when such a familiar face and a guy who had really brought the organization out of the nowhere? Let's face it, they were in the doldrums. They were terrible before Emil got there. What was the feeling with the fans as well as the press corps? Because Emil is such a great personality, and he was a great educator to you guys about hockey, and now you have to make this transition, and then they go hire John Ferguson, and could you tell us a little bit about that?
There were a couple of issues. One of them was that Emil was forever coming out of the executive offices and going to the ice to coach, because unfortunately, each of the guys that Emil picked just didn't work out behind the bench. Now, I don't know whether or not they were psyched by your presence, Emil, or what, but you had one of the greatest one-loss regular season records of any coach in the history of the National Hockey League.
Yeah,
and the guys responded to you. And I guess at that point, I think that, if I'm not mistaken, Emil, didn't you say that you weren't, after you named the last coach, you said, that's it, you are not going to go back anymore.
That's right. That's how I brought in Stewart.
Yes, and you brought Ryan and you were committed to leaving him, to leaving him as the coach. I don't recall what I thought about, other than I thought that it was a shame that he couldn't go out on a high note. But this was already a time when sports was changing so dramatically. There were no rules anymore. Teams. It used to be that teams gave a chance to a coach for a couple of years. A coach had to institute his system. A general manager had to bring the right players in. No one got chances anymore. A year or two, or 12 games, or 20 games, and you were gone. So I think that Emil was a victim of the change, one in change in free agency, a change in the ownership. It used to be that owners had inherited their teams practically. It was family ownership. Now you had corporation ownership.
You had Cohn come in, and he knew nothing about hockey, absolutely nothing. I mean, all the time when...
We're going through that now.
I was just going to say,
same problem. And Cohn knew nothing about it. And like that day, they fired me at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and they fired Stewart at 6 o'clock that night. He was gone at 6 o'clock. Didn't fire Stewart. So to get him, they had to get me, you see?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, Emil, you were in good company, because within a couple of years, I think the Mets fired Yogi Berra. The Yankees were in turmoil. The Jets were in turmoil. The Giants were in the midst of a long stretch. New York sports, after glory days of the late '60s, what happened? You and the Mets and the Jets all came up at the same time, Emil. You all got good at the same time. Now, all of a sudden, things just sort of took it down, and I think that the people in the front office, the Cohns of this world, they panicked.
They panicked.
Mm-hmm. They did not see the big picture in sports, and it was a money situation. Unfortunately, I mean, he might have called me and said, "Jerry, I changed my mind," but he said it and he meant it. I think that's what happened. And I think that all of us at the time, it's a very good question about how I think we all realized that something in sports was changing, and that a little bit of the heart and soul was getting out of it. Now I'm not saying that things were perfect back then. I mean, you had in sports, you had these reserve clauses, and you had these clauses in sports that a player was married to a team forever, and it was up to the ownership to do whatever they wanted with him. But on the other hand, I know that as a kid, and I'm sure, Emil, you remember as a kid, you spent your whole teenage years with the same team. You knew who was at first base. You knew who was at second. You knew who was at short. You knew who was at third. I can still name you the Brooklyn Dodgers numbers from the 1940s and the 50s. These were my guys,
I'm sure. I mean, can you imagine Joe DiMaggio playing for anybody other than the Yankees, or Ted Williams playing for anybody other than the Red Sox, Goldie Hall playing for anybody but Detroit? I mean,
Emil, I'm a voter for the Baseball Hall of Fame. I vote every year for the Hall of Fame. And we have a special committee. We have a special committee that determines what uniform they wear in the plaque. Because players change now. It used to be that if you were good enough for the Hall of Fame, you played almost all your who would have traded you, right? Yeah. You played your whole career with the same. But then what happened is that about 15 or 20 years ago, one or two players actually asked the team for money for $50,000, $75,000. I'll wear your cap for the Hall of Fame. Yeah, it was a scandal. I don't know how much. I don't know how much it's actually come out into the public, but that's the reason now that there's a separate committee and the player doesn't decide what cap he wears. The committee decides what cap he wears.
Yeah, I seen the guy that just got inducted in the Hall of Fame, and he played for the Expos for about 13 years, and he played for the Cubs 3. He wanted to be inducted with the Cubs.
With the Cubs cap, yeah.
They told him you're going with Montreal Expos.
Andre Dawson.
No, that's it. Dawson. You got it. Andrew Dawson, yeah. He wanted to have the Cubs uniform. They said you're going to have Expos.
Gary, I want to know. This is way off topic, but
yes.
Come on, guys. Andre Dawson is a Hall of Famer. I mean,
well, you know,
Gary,
what? Here's the thing. I had a problem in my first couple of years voting for the Hall of Fame, and Emil can understand what I'm talking about. When we were kids, when I was a kid, you were in a Hall of Fame. You were one of the greatest 5, 10, 15, 20 players in history. You were Tris Speaker. You were Cy Young.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Those were the only people. You know, Joe DiMaggio did not get in the first time. Joe DiMaggio, he didn't get in the first ballot. Some people actually left Ted Williams off the ballot, although that might have been because some of the writers didn't like him.
Yeah.
You know,
like
so.
Him, yeah.
But I've come around to the conclusion that you can't go by comparing 1980, 1970, 1990 players with 1925 players. Just like, you know, you can't compare guys today to Rocket Richard.
Yes.
You know, you have to do for today's time. Did he dominate his age? Did he dominate his era? And, does he belong alongside? Well, maybe he doesn't belong in the same – he wouldn't have replaced him, but he has to be, you know, is he good enough? That's why I only vote for one or two guys a year. I very rarely have ever voted for more than – in fact, I've never voted for more than three players for the Hall of Fame. Now, you say Andre Dawson. Well, you know, Andre Dawson was an outstanding player. He has nothing at all to do with DiMaggio, Speaker – any of those, Lou Gehrig, I mean, you can't even compare, you know, those kind of statistics. But he was maybe one of the best of his time, and so that's really all you can go with. I mean, that's the way I look at it. You may disagree with me, but that's the way I look at it.
Absolutely. Same thing in hockey. Like I've been on the Hall of Fame selection committee for 18 years, and here when we had the 75th anniversary, they picked 50 of us. To select who the 50 best players we've ever seen,
Yes.
And my guy, number one guy, is Gordie Howe. Well, when it was all over, the 50 people voted, the number one guy they came up with was Bobby Orr. The second guy was Gretzky, and the third guy is Gordie Howe. But they're from different eras,
Yeah.
But to me, Gordie Howe was the best two-way player and the toughest player that I've ever seen in the National Hockey League. I mean, as good as Orr was, it was a different era. As good as Gretzky was, altogether different, So it's very difficult, very difficult.
And look, and you were a guy that saw all of them at their peak also.
Yeah, I saw them all.
And you saw them at
their prime.
Right, in their prime.
In their prime.
Yes, and that's the decision you made. And I couldn't say that I disagree with you, Emil, because I remember him at when I was reading about hockey, I didn't really cover him that much, but he was so tough and he was so feared. And as far as two-way is concerned, you're absolutely right. Can control a game with push guys off with his stick and all that,
if you think about Gordie Howe, look about today's game, right? Today's game, who would stand out the most? Right, if we put it together right now, Bobby Orr, of course, would stand out. But there's a lot of offensive defensemen now.
Yep.
Wayne Gretzky would be a playmaking center, or maybe a Sidney Crosby type. He would stand out. But Gordie Howe would beat them all because he could score. He was feared. He was rough. He was tough. Two-way player. He would wouldn't you guys agree?
Yeah, well, you know what? I learned my hockey under Emil, so I got to agree with you. I like the guy that skated. Emil used to use this expression. He skated up and down his wing. And he would play the body, play the man, and played two-way. And did they ever keep plus? They didn't keep plus minus in those days, did they, Emil, with Gordie Howe?
I started that.
Did you really?
I started that minus plus. Sure, I started all that. And the hits and the face-offs. No, that's the thing that to give every game out to everybody. Every game they give that out now.
Can I tell you a secret, Emil and Ellis? And I'm going to tell you guys, but I don't want you to repeat this, okay? I get a call one day in training camp. Well, it's before training camp. It's the summertime. Vic Hatfield's agent calls me up, and he says, Jerry, he says, can you find out Vic Hatfield's plus minus? So I said, well, why can't you get it? He says, Emil won't tell us. And he says, do you remember that, Emil? And Emil won't tell us because we believe that Vic is worth as much money as Rattell and Hatfield, and he won't tell us what his plus minus is. So he wants to negotiate.
Oh yeah,
well,
that'd
be he's a smart cookie.
I got to tell you, the first time I ever played against Gordie Howe, I come up to the Chicago Blackhawks. I'd been there about 3 weeks, and we hadn't played Detroit yet. So all of a sudden, now Chicago and Detroit in those days were like Boston, New York. That's where the rivalry was. And then you had Toronto, Montreal, like hell. So we're playing against Detroit. And down comes this guy on right wing, and we had a guy by the name of John Mariucci, who's 36 years old, captain, veteran defenseman. And he's right in the middle, like hell. So I move out because Howe's coming down right wing, and I move out to the top of the crease, and I'm saying to myself, okay, go ahead and shoot. I got you right where I want you. Guess what he did? He changed hands on me. He went from the right-hand shot to the left-hand shot, which gave him a three-foot advantage, like, for the far part of the net. Put the puck in the net. He circled the net. I turned. I looked at him as he went around, and I turned to Mariucci. I says, who the hell is that guy? He said, some kid that just brought up from Omaha. It was Gordie Howe.
Wow.
He changed. I've never seen anybody ever do that before. It's the first time anybody ever had done it on me. Like, I mean, he caught me flat-footed.
Now, Emil, is that a tall tale, or did that really happen? If that really happened, that's one of the greatest stories ever. That is a great story.
It happened, believe me. It caught me flat-footed. I didn't know, because I'd never seen anybody ever do that before, you know? I'm saying to myself, go ahead and shoot now. And he changed hands on me. He became a swift shooter. I've never seen anybody in the league ever do it again after.
That's probably why they gave him number 9. You know, number 9, upon a time, was a number reserved, you know, like number 3, Babe Ruth, you know. I mean, they didn't give it to everyone, you know.
Yeah.
And who wore it? The Rocket wore it, right? Rocket was number 9.
That 9? He was 9, yeah.
Gordie Howe was 9.
Howe was 9.
And I remember...
Bill was 4, I guess.
Yeah, and
four all the time.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. But I don't know who was 9 in that team. Was it Busick maybe or something like that?
I was going to say it was Busick.
Yeah. So they, you know, they reserved that number for the guy that they thought was going to be, you know, their top gun. And that was another nice thing about those days too. You know, it had that sort of that continuity. You know. Well, it was a wonderful time for me, and you know what, Emil, and now you were always hockey. I wrote hockey. I never played the game, but it's amazing to me, Ranger fans' memory. I haven't written a hockey game. Well, I wasn't with a regular hockey writer for say 30 years. I haven't. People still remember when I wrote Ranger hockey because it was so intense for them. You know that they had to get their fill of it every morning.
You would be amazed, you know, even with this show, that people remember things as, you know, when you guys were in your heyday, we were, you know, when we were a little, you know, younger or our fathers, they remember everything. And between periods, they still get together at the Garden, between periods, you know, and everybody's talking, we're talking about the, you know, the rivalries from the old days, they're talking about Leaping Lou Fontanato, we're talking about everybody.
Yeah.
It's something inbred in the Ranger fan that it's even though we don't have the most winning history, we have the most winningest fans. I know it sounds corny, but it's true. The fans are dedicated like none other in America as far as sports goes, and maybe even North America. I mean, you know, that's the way I look at it.
They're the best fans in the world, believe me, and you can't go anywhere, they spot you. I'll tell you, I played in a summer league, a golf league here, and there's 12 teams in the league. And everywhere we go to play, you know, there's New Yorkers all over Florida here. Like, every club we go to, there's guys there, and they come right up. They know right away who we are, like, you know. They don't forget, I'll tell you. Oh, not a bit. And it was recently, 3 years ago, I was in New York, and I was walking down the street, and a cat pulls up. Hey, cat, They know, they spot you, like, you know. They'll recognize you anywhere, I'm telling you. They are something. I was kidding myself. You guys should be in the FBI, you know. They spot you.
Jerry Busick was number 9.
He was.
Yeah, he was, huh?
Yeah. He was number
9. Somebody said Bobby Hull. Bobby Hull number 9?
Yes, of course. And yeah, Bobby Hull. Was. How could I forget Bobby Hull was number 9, of course.
I had a deal made for Jerry for Busick. I'll never forget it.
Ooh.
They had a rookie general manager come in, took over the Bruins, and second trip in New York, I got him in a restaurant for 4 hours, and when I left, I made a deal with him. I was going to trail Errol Engenfield to him for Johnny Busick. And I was going to put Busick with Rattel and Gilbert. So the guy said, well, you know, he says, I'm a new manager here. He says, I have to report to the owner, Weston Adams. As far as I'm concerned, you and I have a deal. But I'll call you tomorrow exactly at noon, because I'll have to tell him tomorrow morning when we get back what I've done. Fine. I couldn't sleep all night. I didn't sleep all night. He called and he said, if he turns me down, I'm through. I'll resign at the end of the year. Sure enough, he called me at noon. He said, well, I've got to tell you, he said, the boss, the owner, Weston Adams, turned me down. And he said, as I told you, at the end of this year, I'm resigning. I'm out of here. Sure enough, that's what happened. I lost the deal, and he resigned. Funny,
wow.
Ever got Busick at that time. They'd have never won 2 Stanley Cups like they did, I'll tell you. He would have been a big asset to us, boy.
Oh,
but,
yeah,
you know,
big time.
Those are the ones
time.
That get away from me, but yeah, that would have been a big one.
We got some questions here that are coming in from our chat room that we have. Emil, people want to know, for some reason, your opinion on Joe Zanussi.
Joe Zanussi was the other guy in the deal. He was just like a throw-in, like, you know. He was a sort of offensive defenseman. He was too small to begin with. He should have been a forward, like, you know. But he
mm-hmm.
was a throw-in in that deal there at Guthrie Hotel and Park, like, you know, for Vadney and Esposito. Yeah, Joe Zanussi. There's a name from the past, I'll tell you.
I know. I told you, people remember this stuff. I mean,
Oh, God, yeah.
You're right.
Well, he became famous because he's part of that deal.
Well, that's right.
A good guy, though. He's a good guy. He worked hard.
And somebody also wants to know about how you were involved with the Metropolitan Hockey League and how that got all started and the story behind that.
I started that whole thing. Yeah, I started that whole thing. It was maybe the first year, second year I took over the Rangers. And we were playing Montreal, like, you know, and I was a general manager, and I was a coach. I was doing everything, and it was about 3:30 in the afternoon. You know, I had all the team meetings, skate, and teach. I was sitting at the house. I had to get out. I had to go for a walk because, you know, Montreal had a great team, and, you don't want to get embarrassed. So I went for a walk, and I went down to 9th Avenue, and I took a right-hand turn. I was walking down there, and I was going right towards Hell's Kitchen, and I didn't even know where I was going, like, you know. All of a sudden, I see these guys going back and forth, like, on. I said, geez, do they have artificial ice at this part of the New York, you know? So I went over there, and I look over, and they're down in, a basement, you know? And guess what? They're playing roller hockey. Well, I stood there. I had never seen roller hockey before in my life. That's the first time I'd ever seen roller hockey. And I looked, and all these young guys are going up and down and hitting and shooting. And I'm standing there, I says, can you believe this? I go, oh, boy. I says, no, this has got to change. I got to do something about this. So anyway, it took me about 3 or 4 days. We got the game over with and that, and I had lunch with Bill James. I said, you know, Bill, I says, our crowds are nothing like they should be, and our team is nothing like it has to be. But I said, we have to start at the bottom here. Once a guy's played hockey, he'll either go on and maybe go to college, get a scholarship, or he'll become a pro player, or once he's ever played, he'll always be a fan, and we got to build a new fan base in New York. He said, what are you proposing? So I told him what had happened. I said, I'd like to start a junior league here, just like we have in Canada where we all come from, like, you know. But I said,
right.
I need ice. So whenever we play at the Garden on Wednesday and Sunday, I need the ice from 1 o'clock to 5. That way I can slip in 2 junior games, and then I'll find other places. I'll start over the 6-team league. Well, he says, we'll have to talk to the chief executive officer. I said, fine. So we met with him. He asked me all these questions, and he said, well, sounds all right. And he said, by the way, he said, you ever think that you could develop a player in New York to play? And I just picked this thing right out of my hat. I said, yeah, I do. How long do you think it'll take? I says, 10 years. He said, you think you can have a guy come out of that league that you're talking about in 10 years and play for the Rangers? I said, yes, I do. And I mean, it was, you know, strictly a guess, like, you know. But guess what?
Right.
The first guy come out of that league was Nicky Fotua. 9 years
yeah.
later.
Yeah.
9 years later. And then, of course, I'll tell you, the proudest moment, even more so than when I went in the Hockey Hall of Fame, is when we had the All-Star game in Edmonton, and there was the West against the East. And Joey Mullen played for the West, and
that's
his
right.
brother played for the East. And those two guys come out of that league. Their dad worked for us at Madison Square Garden. He was a laborer. And I sat there during the national anthem. I looked at one blue line, and there was Joe Mullen. I looked at the other blue line, and there was his brother. Here's the two Mullins
yeah.
that come right out of that league, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, we developed the last out of Hell's Kitchen. That's where they came from, boy.
That's where they're from, yep.
The last I heard, there were 190 kids come out of there and did scholarships, and there's 28 came in the National League from that Metropolitan Junior League. And
you know,
all
Emil,
because
I
went.
I'm sitting here, Emil. I'm thinking, really, is there anything that you hadn't invented? I mean, seriously, you came up with all this stuff before.
Yeah, yeah.
It was, you know,
yeah.
the whole thing to get the
yeah.
people in the seats that you see now where, in these expansion areas where they get kids to play hockey to get them, you know, to become involved in hockey so they can become
yeah.
fans and players later on.
Yeah.
You're way ahead of the curve here. We're talking, you know, late 60s, maybe mid 60s when this starts.
When I started that Metropolitan Junior League, I think it was in 1965.
Wow.
So there's been a lot of water under the bridge since then, like, you know.
44 years. That was the year I was born. Me and the Metropolitan Hockey League share a birthday.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, we let the fans come in for nothing. Another way to build fans, like, you know. And I'd have those games at Madison Square Garden, and we'd have 5,000 people there from the West Siders, like all those kids that played for Hell's Kitchen. They all come into Madison Square. They'd never been to Madison Square Garden in their lives, but hey, we were creating new hockey fans.
Right.
They could come in and see the kids play for nothing, like, you know. It was great.
So, Jerry, getting back to you, I mean, can you encapsulate, like, I guess some of the fans, you know, who are just tuning in, How many years did you cover the Rangers for the Times, and how many reporters that covered hockey from when you started covering the Rangers until you left?
I wrote about them for about 8 years. Then for about 65 to 73. Then for about 3 or 4 years, I didn't cover them. Then we had a guy writing about them in 1978, but was that the John Davidson year when he starred in a playoff, something like that, beat
right,
the Islanders?
Yeah, 78,
right,
79.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, it shows you about what happened was that in the middle of the playoffs, he decided that he would rather write something else, even though he was the hockey writer, so he didn't have the time to do it. So I took over, and I came back out of a sort of hockey retirement to do it. But after that, they had an awful lot of people doing it. See, part of the great thing about doing it when I was doing it, and the reason that guys stayed with it for a while is that
Excuse
you only
me,
had
come
the
minute, guys. Somebody's at the door. I got to go answer the door. I'll be right back.
Okay.
Go ahead, Jerry.
But I'll keep talking. And we had six teams in the league. Now it's hard to explain to people when you've got hundreds and hundreds of players all over the place. There were about 115 players in the league, and about 70 that you saw that played regularly. So I would go into the I remember going into the Bruins locker room one day talking to Derek Sanderson, and Bobby Orr comes over and says, "Well, I didn't even know that Bobby Orr knew me," you know, and that was the kind of thing, because I would see these guys in training camp. I would see them. I'd go up to Kitchener, Ontario. Then I go to London, Ontario, where the Bruins trained. The players were all sort of stayed together in the cheapest motel they could find. I don't know if Emil got a bonus. The rumor was that Emil would get a bonus if he saved money or something. I don't know if that's true or not. And we got to know the players very well. I actually we would travel with them. I remember a magical night sitting in the dining car with Roger Bear just schmoozing in the bar car in a train going up to Montreal. And like I say, I covered it for about 8 years, and then they asked me to do the Jets, and I wound up doing the Jets. And but the whole ambience of sports was changing then. But to me, it was very interesting that a guy who's covering the Rangers in a Stanley Cup run decides that in the middle of the playoffs he's got something more important to do. And
I can't believe that.
I think that one of the problems I had in covering hockey, and it was a problem in a way different from what Emil and you would think. I always felt that a newspaper reporter should never write about a team for more than 3 or 4 years, because what happens is you get to know the people on a very personal basis, and that has to color the way you write. And I always thought that a newspaper reporter should be objective. On the other hand, I wouldn't give up those years of covering the Rangers for anything. Because
you're probably right there, though. You know, that's what happened. Like, in fact, you know, when I took over the Rangers, Jerry, Madison Square Garden couldn't get the papers to cover them. They had to pay the expenses of the people covering them.
Yeah.
And then, of course, everything backed off, like, you know.
You paid the plane fare or the train fare for the New York Post writers to cover.
That's right.
Wow.
You got that right. Sure. That's what you had to do to get them to cover it. Or you
and I remember,
had no coverage at all.
I remember one night one of the Post writers was so drunk he couldn't write, and John Halligan wrote a story for him.
Well, you know what happened? We played in Chicago, and we had to go the next night to Detroit. And the guy didn't come to the game, didn't cover the story. The next night, John Halligan also had a cover for him in the game in Detroit. And the next day, we're leaving the hotel to get on the bus to go. And guess what? He showed up. He missed two games. John Halligan covered for him for two games.
Well, I got to tell you something. I try to wake him up. I saw that he wasn't at practice that day, I didn't see him at lunchtime, and it was like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I knock on the door, and I bang on the door finally about 20 times, and after about the 21st knock, I hear a guy go, "What?" So I said, "Hey, it's time to get up." "All right." And the next thing I know, I go to the game, he's not there. So when I finally saw him, and when he showed up, I said, "Hey!" I said, "You know what happened?" He says, "Well, why didn't you wake me up?" What he used to do is he used to let the water run in a sink very loud, so no one could disturb him. So, do you remember that, Emil?
Oh gosh!
Do you remember?
Yeah,
I don't remember that. He would let the water run.
I know who you're talking about, too.
Yeah, he let the water. Yeah, exactly right. Oh, you got a good memory. So JM would let the water run in the sink. And when he said to me, "Why didn't you wake me up?" I thought, "Oh God, I did everything but break the door in," you know.
Oh, God.
Now, Emil, I know you're aware of this because you're still following the game closely, but right now we have a coach in New York who has had some dealings with the media that have been pretty verbose. They've been kind of, you know, going at each other, him and Larry Brooks. I wanted to know what's your take on that, and then I want to get Jerry's take on that. Was any kind of challenging ever done in the day of a coach's decision or something? So I'll go to you first, Emil, with your take on that situation and your take.
I think that everybody has a job to do. Like, you know, you running the team, coaching the team, as well as the guy that's covering it and on the beat, like, you know. And mm-hmm. I think that he has a right to ask any question he wants to ask, and you have a duty to answer to the best of your ability. But I don't think that at any point in time that you can get in a contest with a writer or writers, like, you know, because they have their job to do. And they may ask you something that, you know, you're not happy with, or why you did this, or why you did that, but they have to write a story. And they ask you something because they need an answer, like, you know. And only one time, I only had one run in with a writer in New York the whole time I was there.
Uh-oh.
And, Chicago Blackhawks were a real strong team at this time, like, you know. And we played on a Saturday afternoon at the Old Garden, and we got beat 1-0. And for our team, I mean, you know when your team is giving you all that they have, like, you know. And we come in at the end of the game, and the press room then was next to where the Ranger dressing room was at. And this guy was about twice as big as me. And I went on and explained, like Jerry said, I used to do about the game itself and who did this and who did that. And so I got a question for you, Caz. Go ahead. He said, I think your team quit today. I said, what did you say? He said, I think your team quit. He said, I'll tell you what. Why don't you and I step out in that hall? And we'll see who's going to quit. And the minute I said, I could have bit my tongue. But, you know, he keyed me on. So, I mean, if they had played bad, and if I thought he was right, I wouldn't probably say him. But, I mean, they had given everything that they could give because we weren't as good as Chicago at that time. And he just turned and he left. He walked out like, on the next day he called me and he said, geez, I shouldn't have. I, you know, he says, I got you mad. I shouldn't have mad. I said, that's all right. I should have answered you the way I did. I said, let's forget it. You know, and that was it, like, you know.
Well, the
only one
that I really remember, Emil, as being a second guesser was Stan Fischler. And Stan, of course, knew hockey, but I think that Stan probably went out of his way to second guess decisions. And it probably wasn't only yours. It was probably all the teams that he covered over the years, you know.
Well, that's how he made a living.
Yeah.
That's how he made a living, like, you know.
Yeah.
And in fact, I threw him out of the garden. I took all his credentials away. But it wasn't because of what he wrote or that he said this.
Abel, we wanted to ask you about that because we heard that story after you were on with us the last time. So I had that on my list of questions to ask you tonight. So I'm glad you bring the story up. I want to hear about you throwing Fischler out of the
garden. Yeah, but what happened? Like, you know,
wasn't his wife, too?
Well, that's what happened. You see, like, there was an all-star game in Montreal. And for some reason or other, they let women reporters go into the dressing room. Well, 2 days later, I get a call from John Rattel's wife, and she said, I have two of the other wives, and we'd like to meet with you. I said, fine. So they come in, and they said, we hope that you never, ever let women reporters into the Ranger dressing room. I said, well, it's never happened before. It's not going to happen as long as I'm around here, you know. So anyway, Stan Fischer we were at that time training in Kingston, Ontario, and he'd been at training camp. He got to know the guy in the Kingston Frontenac, which is a paper. And he got them to designate his wife as a reporter to get credentials. And, of course, John Helgen came in looking for credentials for his wife.
It was Stan's wife.
And I said, I could do that. I said, she could be in the press box. He said, but she also wants credentials to get in the dressing room. I said, there's no way. No woman's going in that dressing room. Well, they took me to court, to the Supreme Court in Brooklyn. Oh, yeah, they took me to court, like, you know. And the judge ruled that she had to have credentials to go everywhere except where men undressed. So that meant that she could go in the press box, and she could go, like, you know, where all the reporters went after the game, where we had press conferences and what have you. And that's when the little war started with he and I. And I threw him out, I threw her, I took all his credentials away. We turned out after we became friends again, like, oh, but I said, the next time you come to Madison Square Garden, you'll have to buy a ticket because you're out of here. You know, so anyway, I forgot all about that.
That's great.
I'm glad you brought that back up there, but we're friends now, have been for years.
Can I tell you a woman in the locker room story? You know, at first, when the first women started to write about hockey, they would bring the players outside the locker room, as you remember, Emil. They wouldn't let them inside, but they would interview them. Then eventually, I hadn't covered hockey in a few years, and now a big guy named Phil Esposito joins the Rangers. So I go in the locker room, and there, Phil Esposito is toweling himself off, and next to him is the Daily News reporter, Lori Mifflin. Lori is 5 foot tall. Phil Esposito has got his leg up on a dressing table.
I know where this is going.
Talent,
I don't like
well,
where this is going.
But she's there. God bless Lori. She never took her eyes off a notepad.
She probably had no reason to.
She's scribbling the whole time. Emil, it was the damnedest sight I ever saw. Phil toweling himself off like nothing's happened. I thought he started to sing an aria or something, you know? And he's toweling himself. And I said to myself, boy, I said, sports has really changed.
Now, what year are we talking about?
That should happen.
Had to be, what, 76? 74 maybe? 74?
74, 75?
Well, he came to the Rangers in 76.
Yeah,
came to the Rangers in 76? So
yeah,
that's when it was.
Yeah, he came in 76.
So that's when it was.
Is that when women started to cover the game? Or
yes. I'm sorry.
At the All-Star game in Montreal. Sure. Yeah, they're the first ones. The first time a woman was ever... Two women ever in a hockey dressing was in Montreal at that All-Star game, and they went in there, and that's when the Rattel's wife, and she had two other wives with her. I hope you never let women come in the Rangers dressing room.
They must have been livid.
Well, one of the reporters was a woman named Robin Herman, and Robin had just
I know you are.
Right. You remember Robin? She had just gotten out of college in 72 or 73 from Princeton, and Laurie that same year graduated from Yale. And Robin was going to succeed me as the Rangers hockey writer. And I remember we drove up to Kitchener, Ontario, and then I think we went to Peterborough because the Islanders were starting as well, and they were in Peterborough. And I remember that's what I said before about the women were not allowed in a locker room. But by the mid 70s. I guess before the trade was made, because you say Rattel's wife came, they had actually gone into that locker room. I mean, it's a very strange thing that even all the sports I cover, when I tell contemporaries of mine that I go in a locker room and there are women in there with the naked men, they're incredulous. It does seem incredible. But I'll tell you this, the women's tennis tour has never allowed men into the locker rooms while they're getting while they're naked.
You think you could go in where Chris Evert was playing after? Are you kidding?
Absolutely.
No man ever got into a woman's. How do you figure that one out?
Where could I have signed up for that one?
Yeah. What about equal rights for us guys?
And that was always my argument.
Well, wait a
second. How come they want to come in our room and no one ever goes in their room? You know?
Well, you know, I don't know if you've seen some of those golfers. You might not want to go in there, but certainly. But you're right. What about equal rights?
You know, Jerry, I wanted to. Me and Jerry talked about. Kind of a little, we're going to go with the theme, but it's more of a question here. Jerry wanted me to ask you about the Russians. We have the Olympics coming up, and your thoughts about the Russians at that time, you know, back in the 70s, and what you thought about international play in the Olympics.
Well, first of all, I was against it. When they brought the proposition, I was still in the National Hockey League running a team. And when they brought that proposition up to use National League players to play in the Olympics, I was totally against it, and I'll tell you why. The American dream for kids is to play for their country in the Olympics. And the 1980 Olympics, and I was there for 10 days, was the biggest event that I've seen, the biggest upset I've ever seen in sports. And Tommy Ivan was running Chicago, and I was running St. Louis, and the National League selected us to work with Herb Brooks, like, you know, as consultants in picking the team, the 1980 team. So I'd gone to their summer camp for two straight years to watch a whole progression and help and make suggestions as who we thought was good enough and this and that. So I knew all those guys real good, plus Craig Patrick was an assistant coach with the 80 team, like, you know. And when they went for this, the National Hockey League, to let professional players play in the Olympics, they took the dream away from the American kids. The American kids' dream was to play in the Olympics. Canadian kids, their dream was to play in the National League. They weren't concerned about the Olympics. All they wanted to do was to get the professional hockey or the National League as quick as they could. But the American kids, that was what they wanted to do. And those kids in 1980, I mean, the same team that they beat the Russians. They beat us in Madison Square Garden the year before in a three-game series. They won the first, we won the second, and they beat us 6-0 the third. And this is the same team that those kids, all but one, were all college players. And
right.
that's taken away their dream. And I'm against it to this day. I never would be for that. And they said,
yeah,
well,
so,
how do you expect to beat the Russians? I said, they beat them. If they can beat them, we should beat them. Let's not worry about that. But let's not take
right.
that game away from those kids. And I'm still, that's my opinion. I'll never change.
That's
couldn't agree
thing.
With you more, Emil.
Yeah, I couldn't
yeah.
agree with you more on that one. Okay, go ahead, Jim.
No, go ahead, Eddie.
I just wanted to ask one more question, and then I'll be done. I never get enough. But what was the thought about the Russians? There was such a mystique about the Soviets back then. I mean, you know, they were communists. We hated them, and they
yeah.
had this different style of hockey. And what was your thoughts on that whole the whole thing back then?
Well, I hated them, to tell you the truth, because they were honest. That's number
one.
I hated them. Like, you know, and I'd like to have had a chance to get a team together and play against them, because it would kill those bums. Now, they played a different game, like, you know, and they were sneaky. They were dirty. They were the type of guys that come up from behind you and kick your feet from underneath you, like, you know. They moved their puck. I mean, they did a lot of good things, but they did a lot of bad things, like, you know. And they're the type of a team you'd like to get in and a rink 200 feet by 85 and then go to work on them, like, you know.
Right.
They didn't play a physical game. They played a sneaky game, like, you know. They remind me a lot of Philadelphia, like, you know. When Philadelphia were the Broadway goons or whatever the hell they call them, Broadway, what did they call
Street
them?
Bullies.
Broad Street Bullies.
Broad Street Bullies.
Bullies, like, you know. But I'll tell you, when one was traded over here and one was traded over there, those teams, they got them. Because they were like a gang. They were like a pack gang, like, you know. And that's not the way hockey was meant to be played. Not the way that they played it. And they didn't win two Stanley Cups because of the way they played, by being what they were. They won two Stanley Cups in a row, and they did, and they've never won since, because of their goalkeeper. Their goalkeeper won the Stanley Cup for them. Perrault was great. They've never won since, and I hope they never win again.
Amen to that. Amen.
Yeah.
You preach
now,
it to the choir.
Yeah. Now, I'll tell you the team, the country I always had respect for, was the Czechoslovakians. Because Czechoslovakians played more like North Americans play. Russians didn't play like North Americans. Czechoslovakians did. Swedes didn't play like North Americans. Finns didn't play like North Americans. You know, they played that circle hockey, go around in circles and pass this and pass that. But Czechs, I liked the way the Czechs played. Czechs played like North Americans. They'd play, you know, a big part of hockey is hitting. And they've taken that out of our game today. Like I said,
yeah.
40 hits. You won't see 40 hits in a month in our league today, the way they're playing. You won't see 40
yeah.
hits in a month. But hitting is a big part of hockey. They ain't taking it out. Because the mistake that they made, I was on the rule committee for 20 years. They put players on the rule committee. What do you think players are going to say? Well, we shouldn't have the clutching, we shouldn't have the grabbing, we shouldn't have the hitting and all this crap, because it extends their careers. They're the worst guys in the world to put on the rules committee. Bettman put them on there. The commissioner, in order to get a collective bargaining agreement, he agreed to put three players on the rules committee. Are you kidding? There was never a player on the rules committee all the years I was there. I mean, who the hell did it tell you how to play the game? They're told how to play. Don't tell us how to play the game. No way. That's why
yep.
the game has changed. All
I
because
agree.
Of the last collective bargaining. That guy that plays with the Rangers. Yeah, that guy was the Rangers there. He was a big wheel on that. And he was a goal scorer. What do you think he's going to say? I don't want any
exactly.
hitting. I don't want any hooking. I don't want any hitting because he wanted to maintain his game. Are you kidding? We never had a
yeah.
scoring the rules committee all the years I was there. They changed the game.
Yeah. Well, before we let you guys go, I just want to say that we appreciate both of you being on. We're going to take one call for you. This is one of our loyal listeners, and he
sure.
wanted to ask a question. Ricky, are you there?
Hey, guys. How are you?
Hey, Ricky. You're on the Blue Shirt Banner Radio with Jim and Eddie and Emil and Jerry. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. Emil, how are you? I talked to you last time. Again, it's an honor and a privilege to be on the
yep.
phone with you. Quick question.
Very good.
A bunch of my guys and I have over 3,600 hours of nothing but hockey fights and on video, and I'm a huge collector and passion of mine. I got a quick question for you. There's a lot of talk about a John Benarski and a Jim Troy fight with Dave Schultz in the preseason, and I was wondering if you remember that, because I heard Troy gave it to him pretty good at the Garden one year, and there's no video of that. And the second part is I want to ask you, since MSG destroyed their library, do you have any old vintage coaching tapes or highlight reels or anything at home that might surface one day?
You know, I'll have to look at that because I got a lot of stuff here, but I was sure to look at that. No, I don't remember that at all. John Benarski was a good, tough kid like you know, but I don't remember that with Troy at all. And this fight was at Madison Square Garden?
Yeah, supposedly it was a preseason game.
Is that right? I can't recall that at all. I'm
okay.
Sorry, I can't.
And what about the Ron Howard Schultz fight from 76? I'm sorry, 77, I believe, at the Spectrum during the preseason. Do you remember that one?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't. The best fight I remember, I was running St. Louis, and I had a guy in St. Louis. He's the toughest guy I've ever seen in the National Hockey League. And he took on the guy who now is a general manager of Philadelphia. And he beat him up. Pardon? Bob Gassoff.
Yeah. They say he was the greatest
Gassoff.
Ever.
Oh, I've never seen anybody like him, I'll tell you. I took over St. Louis, and I guess we went to Vancouver. And we're losing 1-0 with a minute to go in the game. I pull the goalkeeper. We win the faceoff, and comes back to Gassoff. I had him on the point. I mean, he no more could handle a puck like I could go to the moon. But I put him on the point. He took about 6 feet in. Everybody stayed away. They were afraid to take the puck away from him because he's like, I hit him right over. He shot, and he scored. So we tie the game. Now we go back. We shoot the puck in their end, and it's a faceoff to the left of the net again. I put him back in the point, like, you know. Our centerman went to face off back to Gassoff, and he's from British Columbia. He's right from there. He walks in, gets about 20 feet away. Nobody touches him. Bang, he scores. We win 2-1. Well, after the game, all the reporters from Vancouver, they nailed me after the game and said, Jesus, what have you done with Gassoff? I mean, he's really improved. The way he handles the puck and the way he shot that puck, he tied the game. A wonder for you guys. I didn't say him, but the reason he did is because they're all afraid to take the puck away from him. Like, I couldn't believe it. I've never seen that before. I've never seen it since. But he was the toughest guy I've ever seen on skates, believe. If you're a guy that's interested in fights, try to get a fight in Philadelphia with he and the guy who's the general manager. He was a tough guy. He's the general manager of the Flyers right now.
Paul Holmgren.
Paul Holmgren. So now, we go out to start the game, and I have Gassoff. He's a defenseman. They put out Holmgren. And Holmgren comes out, now believe this, he's wearing a catcher's mask. A catcher's mask, you know, like a catcher in baseball would wear. Whoop, I put my hand up. I yell at the referee, come on over here. So he comes over and says, what's that guy doing out there with that catcher's mask on? Well, he said he broke his nose in the last fight he had the other day with Gassoff. Well, I said, he can't wear a catcher's mask. I mean, he wants to protect his nose and that. Tell him to put a plastic mask on there. No. I said, a guy could break his hand if he hits him. No, he said, he can wear that. I said, you're full of crap. But anyway, he let him wear it. The puck was dropped, and guess what? Holmgren come towards Gassoff, and Gassoff hit him and drove that mask about 4 feet off his head and then kicked the crap out of him. Oh. And when Gassoff fight, when he would fight, his eyes would roll like a pinball machine. Oh, boy, I'll tell you. He was the toughest guy I've ever seen in hockey. Plus,
wow.
The fact he's a little crazy. It didn't hurt.
Well,
you know?
That doesn't hurt, right, Emil?
Yeah. But if you can get if you can ever get a fight with he and that Holmgren, you'd love that one, I'll tell you.
All right. Well, Emil and Jerry, we appreciate you guys coming on with us tonight, and I hope you'll both come back maybe next month or a little later in the season, and we'll catch up with you guys again. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay, now you know why I enjoyed covering the Rangers all those years, huh?
Yeah.
Jim and Eddie, has been a pleasure for me, and especially you pulled a surprise on me tonight because it's really been nice talking to my friend Jerry Eskenazi.
Thank you.
Yeah,
nice to talk to you again, Jerry.
Yes. Okay. Well, what's that, Emil? At what?
He said it was nice to talk.
I thank both Jim and Eddie for having me on, and I said thank you very much because they told me we got a surprise for you.
Okay.
And they did when they brought you on. It was real nice talking to you again and forming old relationships.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I felt the same way, Emil. It was really not only warm and fuzzy, it was cold and freezing too, but it was great. It was great.
All right, guys.
They tell me the Rangers have a different practice rink now where they cover like a $25 million practice rink. It's a little different than the little joint we had in New Hyde Park, Jerry.
Yeah, oh, yeah. It's Gateland. Well, the one that you created out in Long Beach.
That was about bad, but not worth $25 million, believe me.
Yeah.
Okay, guys.
Take care.
All right.
Take care, fellas. We love you.
See you, guys.
Good night.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night, John Boy.
Good night, Mary Ellen.
Good night, Jerry. Thank you.
Okay, fellas.
Take care.
All right. Wow. I mean, what can you say? Fantastic.
It's just a range of education. I mean, you know,
it's like we keep telling you guys, you know, the stories these guys know, they have to continue. We have to find ways to make sure that these stories are told forever because, you know, none of us are going to be around forever. And it's great to hear this stuff. I absolutely love it. I could go another 2 hours listening to the two of them talk, and that was a lot of fun, Eddie.
Oh, yeah, it was great. And I know everybody wants to get down to brass tacks and talk about the acquisition. So let's get right into it.
All right, so we're gonna. Since we ran a little late, we'll skip that break we talked about, I guess, and
screw that break.
All right, we will segue. I will hold it for the next 49 minutes. During the show, I sit here and I drink bottles of water, and I usually go through three or four during a 2 hour show. So now we're doing a 3 hour show, so I might be six bottles of water in. Unlike the other day where I had something a little more adult beverage, you know, while we did the show, that was fun. But I got to go to work tomorrow, so I can't do that.
Right.
But all right, so let's talk about the trade. We'll get to it. We'll get Ricky on. We'll keep Ricky on the line, and we got our usual suspects. Bring him in a minute here. We have the trade that you first heard might be coming down about 2 weeks ago on this program, thanks to Ricky leaking some information for us. He talked about Kotalik, being on the trading block, and he denied it, and the Rangers denied it, and the beat writers crapped all over us for it, and yet here we are now, and Alex Kotalik is no longer a Ranger, Eddie. So who was right and who was wrong?
Well, we were right, and the fans were always right. I mean, what did you expect them? Like I said, to say, yes, Alex Kotalik hates the coach and he's leaving? I mean, what were they going to say? So I think we've gained a little bit of respect. Not that we were looking for it, but just, you know, we're all Ranger fans. And, I thought it was a slap to the Ranger fan that they've kind of put, like, you know, this, well, this rumor came from the internet.
Right,
and,
right.
Kind of like, well, the lowly fans have come up with this rather than the media types, but it is rumored that the one media type is going to give us credit, and if he does, I won't be calling him Zipperhead anymore.
Well, also, I got word from Jolton Joe Fortunato that in his live chat today, he was not very complimentary to those that do their business on the internet, specifically, obviously, meeting us. So, whatever. You know what? At this point, I don't give a crap. Our listeners, our readers, they know we had the story first, and that's all that matters. That's all that matters. I don't give a crap about about Newsday. Well, you know what are they going to do? Put us on the front page? You know, with our picture?
That'd be
nice. That'd be fun. Well, we got a few we could send them. But anyway, let's talk about
your
trade.
What's your take on the trade? I really haven't talked to you about what you like, what you don't like, if there's something you like, or is there, I mean, what's going on with you?
I'll tell you, like Emil said, I got to see Jokinen quite a bit when he played with the Panthers, living down there. And he was a guy I liked. I'm not crazy about him. I don't think he's any kind of savior, but I think he's better than what they have as a first line center. If they're not comfortable with Dubinsky there, if he is going to play that position, and look, he comes to the team and automatically becomes what, their third leading scorer. So, I'll tell you, to be honest, I'm almost more excited about the other guy they got. Is it Proust? Prust?
Brennan Prust.
Prust. There you go.
That's the way I say it.
He's the type of guy they need more of. They might need two or three more of him, but I think it's a deal to get rid of some bad salary, and it sets him up, to either make another deal as we get closer to the trading deadline, or just get to the off season. Jokinen's salary will come off the books. Then they don't have Kotelik's salary there anymore. Jess Rubenstein made a great point on Prospect Park that actually Puck Daddy picked up today. Jess said that he's just afraid that this just gives them more money to make another bad move.
Right. I mean, we have inmates running the asylum up there. I mean, now that you ask my take on it, I'll give it to you.
Now, the other thing I wanted to give you credit for is that, what was it, about 8 weeks into the season, you were done with Chris Higgins. And you said, it's time to get rid of Chris Higgins. And, again, you were right.
Well, listen, I don't want to take credit for that, but I'm wrong on plenty of other things we could go through. I also had Enver Leeson down for 15, 20 goals this year, too. So anyway, my take is this. Ole Jokinen, he drove the fans crazy in Calgary. They did not like him. He was his fifth there, $5 million, getting $5 million. What did he get, 11 goals? Yes, and he's on the downside of his career. Can he help the New York Rangers? Yes. And that's basically because the Rangers are so anemic offensively that, he's better than Erik Christensen, let's face it. So I don't think that is the major improvement. I like Prust a lot, and I think this works into another Ricky O muttering or a rumor about Brashear possibly learning his Russian, brushing up on his Russian. I think Brashear is going to be moved. I think Prust is going to fill the enforcer role very well. He fights well. He fights often. That's what the Rangers need. The fact that they got Calgary to take Kotelik off our hands, again, it's some of that magic dust that they used on Bob Gainey when we got rid of Gomez. I don't know how they did it.
Yeah.
And, I don't know how they did it.
DB Maven, last night, it was funny, for the Calgary Flyers game last night, we did an open thread on Blue Shirt Banner because I figured a lot of people would be watching that game, and it actually was pretty successful. We had a whole bunch of guys there. We had about 400 comments, and DB Maven made a joke about Glenn Sather uses the Jedi mind trick to make these trades. it's funny. It's true. I mean, if you need to, think about what Emil Francis said to us at the beginning of his conversation and apply it to this trade. Who got the best player in this trade? I would say that's Ole Jokinen, right?
I don't know. I mean, you've seen him play. I haven't seen him play, but from what I hear, he's a little bit screwy. He's been reported at some organizations and some players that have played with him as a hockey cancer in the locker room. I don't know. Yeah. But
you know, a lot of guys. We see a lot of guys in sports get you see a lot of guys in sports get that tag, and then, you know, a change of scenery cures all. You know, this is still a guy who's a 30 goal scorer just a couple of years ago. You know, put up 20 goals for Phoenix last year. And you're only on the hook. You're on the hook for him for 3 months. So what damage could he really do when you think about it? Is he going to tear this team apart and send them on a losing streak?
He might rip apart that great sensitivity and bondness that the Rangers have in the dressing room. Give it a break. I know what you're saying there. I got a feeling Chris Higgins might turn it around. Might do something. I think Aleš Kotalikas, he doesn't even want to be there. I mean, if there's three teams you got to pick you don't want to be on in your contract, you pick Calgary. I don't know where you come up with that. You know what I'm saying? I mean, yeah. I could see if it was the Islanders or some team like that.
I was watching the Flames broadcast of the Flames-Flyers game last night. And Doug McLean said that the Calgary Flames are absolutely convinced that Chris Higgins they can turn Chris Higgins back into the player he was in Montreal. And then he said, I don't know what they're thinking with Aleš Kotalikas.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I feel. I think, you know, Higgins could be salvaged. Kotalikas is what he is, and I just think Tortorella, I mean, well, Tortorella was the reason that Kotalikas he hated playing for Tortorella. So, I mean, I think the Rangers needed to make a deal. And listen, they got cap space. Now let's hope they don't squander it on some dopey move at the trading deadline. And then last night, people were ready to jump out the window. I was telling you about this last night, about when there was a rumor about Callahan being traded. Holy cow. People are like, I'm going to punch the wall. I'm going to kill my neighbor. I mean, they were ready to go into any kind of random acts of violence if Ryan Callahan was traded. I mean, you mentioned that kid's name, and people go nuts.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I didn't hear any substantiated rumors. I mean, it's a good deal. Is it a great deal? No. But it's a good deal. And I'll take that.
You know, I think it's a good deal on a couple of levels. It gets a guy out of here who was two guys really who weren't doing much of anything. It frees up some money and it brings in a guy that can help them. It brings in two guys that can help them. It on paper it fills two needs and it also is a little bit of addition by subtraction. And I don't know what more you could ask out of that when you make a deal. You know, it's like you said, it's not a blockbuster. But it's a good deal, and I don't. You know, what else can you say about it?
Apparently, Glenn Sather has appeared on the grid. Then we must maintain radio silence as Glenn Sather is being interviewed by John Giannone. So you know, John Giannone, I'm sure he's going to ask us some tough questions. Like,
oh yeah,
yeah. You know, it'll be like,
how was your holiday?
What do you have for breakfast? Yeah. What do you have for breakfast? You like those lattes?
And I mentioned this in the chat room, but I'll also mention it here. I've been getting several messages from the SB Nation Hockey Google group there's a Google group that the hockey managers can converse in on different subjects, but apparently the hot rumor is that Kovalchuk is going to the LA Kings, and that deal may be very close to being done. Whether or not that's true, you know, who knows? But that is the word on the street.
That would be a big deal.
Yeah.
Hopefully, Kovalchuk they don't make that deal right before game time, and then Kovalchuk appears. They're gonna have enough problems tonight. This Kings team is stacked, but you know. I think this is it does help the Rangers on a couple levels with Pruss, but I think this is the end or the very end of Donald Brashear as a Ranger. I don't know how it's going to end. I would love to see them pull like a total covert move and make believe that Brashear jumps to the KHL without their permission, even though they know it, then they would be off the hook for the salary. And then they pay him under the table. So, or he might be loaned to the KHL. I, you know, sometimes these thoughts appear in my head, usually when Ricky O IMs me in private. But he says that Brashear might be loaned to the KHL to hone his skating skills on that big ice surface.
Yeah.
So, you know, and let's just talk about this now. We're talking about Brashear. I mean, come on. What, you know, what just a dumb move. I mean, just what a disaster.
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing else you can say about it.
Every angle. I mean, but I don't know. Listen, I got a new guy to root for. You know, Jokinen is wearing a Rangers sweater, so we root for him. And so that's the scoop. And, you know, we look forward to it. I'm looking forward to the game tonight. If the Rangers can pull out this one, is Henrik back in net tonight?
I honestly have not heard as of yet. Maybe you want to bring the you want to bring the peanut gallery in and
bring them in because I want to hear their take because I want to hear all the fans' takes on what's really important to me.
All right,
while you bring them on,
let me.
I just want to say that this Sunday I had a real blast talking to the Ranger fans at that VFW thing I did. I talked to Paul and his son Michael. We talked puck. Jason and Josh and Ranger Dude was there. I talked to him, and we talked puck, and it was like, I'm telling you, I had a lot of fun, and I appreciate everybody coming down and talking to me. And Ranger Dude has just confirmed Hank is in net. Now go ahead with Peanut Gallery.
All right, let's bring everybody in, and let's see. We got Mandar's on the line. Ricky's on the line. I believe DB Maven has joined us. James is there. James, hold on. There's James. Okay, and we got the, I don't know who this is. 631-849. Who is this?
Critical.
Oh, Critical. Okay, so we got the whole gang in here. Why don't we go, we'll start with Mandar. Mandar, what are your, give us your thoughts on this trade.
It's a no-brainer. It really is. You're getting a guy. Is Jokinen a rental, or is he just a guy that they were able to get so they could take a contract and have it expiring at the end of the year? It's nothing. And you know what? You never know. I mean, I hear that he's more of a shooter than a passer, and God knows we need a bunch more of those kind of guys anyway. The chemistry is what I'm just kind of concerned about. Not that he's a cancer in the locker room that we've heard, but just more about the, you know, chemistry with line mates. I look at this Ranger team, I don't see line mates that necessarily fit in with him. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how many sets of line mates he gets to go through tonight. I'm thinking that Torts is going to use him with any more, probably about 9 or 10 combinations like he would do in any normal night.
Yeah.
So you're a definitive yes on this trade. Everything is
absolutely
perfect.
And a definitive yes because you could you're not replacing Higgins' 6 goals. I mean, we could get PA Parento to do the same thing. So no loss at all. And of course, the biggest plus of all is contracts for both of these guys end of the year come off the books. Then you make your decision.
All right, there you have it.
All right,
Man,
who's next? Ricky, give us your thoughts on the trade.
Oh, I absolutely love the trade. I mean, I've been ecstatic. I've been complaining about Pruss since last trade deadline when he got traded from Phoenix back up to Calgary for nothing. And we took players like Leeson and Carcillo was traded out of there, and we didn't get him either. Jokinen, you know what? Worst comes to worst. He comes in, clicks with Gavrik, scores 5-10 goals down the stretch. We make the playoffs. Worst case scenario, he's gone at the end of the year. No, you know, no skin off anybody's back. We save $3 million.
Okay.
All right.
Now,
how about...
go ahead. No,
go ahead.
I did, It wasn't that great of a question.
Eddie, just
all right.
So you know, I'll give you another little bit of a tidbit today. With Brashear. First one I'm hearing, and you hit it on the head with the KHL, first thing I'm hearing is he might be loaned to a team out there and leaving before the trade deadline. And the second thing I heard today was that the Washington Capitals might be interested in reacquiring him because he's close friends with Ovechkin. There's a lot of teams that are taking liberties with the Caps, and Ovechkin is pushing a little bit to get an enforcer back in the lineup. So watch the Capitals whip this year.
Boy, loan him to the KHL. You talk about a loan with no collateral, no interest, and we're in no hurry to get paid back for it.
Interest free, baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll pay you.
Yeah. Buy here, pay here. DB Maven, give us your thoughts.
Oh, I just want to say before DB Maven speaks, he is the Twitter of the week. Let me tell you, he's all over that Twitter.
Oh,
I mean, he's holding court, Jim. He's holding court over there. He's calling people to the carpet. He's calling me to the carpet. He's reigning supreme on Twitter. I just wanted to say that.
I've been in rare form this week, especially the last 2 days with some one-liners. I mean, in 140 characters, you have to use one-liners. So I've been in rare form.
You have? So go ahead. Give us your take.
My take on the trade is nothing would make me more ecstatic than to see Brashear go back to the Capitals. That would literally make my week. Ricky, I'm telling you, if that comes to pass, holy cow. That would be just wonderful to get his whatever's left of this year and next year at $1.4 million on their ass instead of ours. Oh, my God. That would be epic. This trade is, everybody said, is a no-brainer. I mean, the biggest benefit, the super win, as far as I'm concerned, is $3 million for 2 more years off the books. I don't give a shit who's involved from a player standpoint. It doesn't matter. You got to love Prust. It's Prust like Rust. You got to love the guy. I'm with Ricky. This is a no-brainer.
All right. Now, hold on. We got two. Real quick, I also brought in John. John, how are you?
John.
Are you there? All right. Well, while we figure out where John is, let's also bring in, we have a man on the scene at the Staples Center in Los Angeles, California. It is Fred. Fred, good evening and welcome to the program. How are you?
Hey, Ed. What's shaking? I'm out here line trying to go through the screening process where they check everything but your prostate to get into this building.
Let me just say,
because I could use a check.
Ladies and gentlemen,
I looked at who's checking. Maybe not this person. There's tons of Ranger fans out here. We had a chant going up a few moments ago of "Let's Go Rangers" with a guy with a championship banner, and there's uniforms all throughout, including my own with my discount jacket that I got at Modell's last April when I was in New York with the 4 championship trophies displayed proudly on it, and the zipper that didn't work instantly. So, much like the Rangers, it doesn't work. But I feel today I'm predicting a 4-2 Ranger victory tonight because Rangers always win for me here at Staples, as opposed to my quasi-jinxing of last year's playoff debacle where I pissed away over $400 on tickets in 3 games and only had satisfaction once.
Now, for you folks who don't know who this is, this is Fred the Grump Wodnicki, a guy I met at a playoff game. I loved him. I put him on my videos. He did videos for me. So, ladies and gentlemen, you are hearing live from the Staples Center, Fred the Grump Wodnicki. Fred, can you give me the kind of crowd that shows up at a Staples Center game, kind of a description?
Gruesome looking and and lots of hot chicks who pretend they like hockey so they can get laid.
Well, who cares? Who cares why they're there?
Yeah.
As long as they're there.
Yeah.
Now, do these fans, are they into their team? Do you see a lot of Drew Doughty jerseys, a lot of Andrei Kopitar jerseys out there?
Well, I got a Robitaille jersey next to me here. So that's old school yellow and gold and purple. There's there's a Camilleri, whoever the frick that is, and a Frolov jersey. Who the fuck are these? I'm sorry. Who the heck are these Kings? I don't even know them anymore. Here's a number 3, a Johnson. There's a 32. Don't know who that is. There's another Robitaille. Yeah, just a bunch of cretins.
Okay, and now I have to say, you know, I've been to the games with you, and what kind of concession fare do they have? Are you going to be imbibing any adult beverages, or are you going to stick to a straight Coke?
I'm glad you asked, because as with any good game at Staples Center, I must smuggle in my vegan food because this place doesn't serve much except for maybe some greased-up fries that no doubt were cooked with something that's dead. So in my left sleeve, I have stuffed some bagged pretzels and peanut butter pretzels, as well as some Twizzlers. In my right sleeve, I have a bottle of water. It's allowed, but I don't trust them, so I figure I might as well balance out my muscles with this skinny body. And in my left inside pocket, I have a vegan burger with tomatoes, relish, pickles, and ketchup that I stuffed into the pocket very carefully, which hopefully won't leak inside my broken Ranger jacket.
This guy's like Han Solo going into a game here.
I can actually open up my vegan stand, but I don't think there's going to be any vegans here that want anything, so...
Now, do you have a George Foreman grill tucked in your pants?
No, I have to leave that out in the car. I was already full. This coat's full. That's my official smuggling wear for anybody who needs to smuggle anything into an arena. You stick it down your sleeves. You can get anything you want in here, including probably a bomb. But they never look at that. But this place actually has this place is actually tougher to get through than an airport. These stupid metal detectors here, you have to take out every freaking thing. I think you almost have to remove your zippers because those set it off. You need to come with a tailor so you can put your zipper back on after you get through the damn metal detector.
Now, once you get through this security here, it's like you're going into Iraq here. I mean,
oh, please, Iraq is easier.
Now, you've had a chance to watch the rain. What's the region this year? What's been your opinion so far of what you see?
They're great. They suck. They're great. They suck. They're okay. They suck. They're pretty good. They're okay. They suck. They suck, suck, suck. They're okay. They suck. And the last game I saw, which was thankfully an entire game that they actually won, because normally I only sit through Rangers and 60 out here because, A, it's cheap. It's free. And, B, you know, if you're going to lose, you might as well watch it in 60 minutes. Although I must say I have been going through a lot of skipping this year. The 15-minute DVR, like the, was it Phoenix game the other day? It was 2-0 inside of a couple of minutes, and I hit skip, skip. It became 2-1. I got suckered in, and then, of course, we lost. So then the last game I watched, we actually won an entire game, and so I got the bargain on that one. No.
Right. So you know, sometimes you look at the glass half empty, but you're positive the Rangers will come out with a win tonight.
Actually, I always look at the glass half empty, but tonight I do believe we will win. And we're going to knock those dopey Kings off of their cheap throne that they built this last road trip they apparently were on, where they beat up on crappy teams like the Devils and who knows who else.
Now
they come back down to reality.
You sense any arrogance from the Kings fan? Will you be going toe-to-toe? You're kind of a quiet guy. I mean, I've been around. Then again, anybody compared to me is quiet. But go ahead.
Are you kidding? These specified fans, they're too busy drinking their lattes. They have no business being in a hockey game. Whipped cream, nuts, the whole freaking thing. I think they actually think they're at like some kind of a Andre Bocelli concert or something, but they went to the wrong place. You know where they really should be is they really should be across the street, because as I was coming through the fancy Staples Center, what the hell do they call this thing, LA Live zone, there was Pee Wee Herman doing a concert here, so they should probably be over there. Yeah,
Pee Wee Herman's
back. Yeah, he's
coming
back
to a theater near you.
And hopefully he's not sitting behind you. As we all know, what happens then.
Have you seen anybody famous showing up for the Kings-Rangers game tonight? Any stars out there?
You mean other than the Grump? No, I don't think we get Nicholson in the front row here. There's probably some lower-tier level B celebrity down there, but I don't know who they are because I'm always in the upper deck. But I am at center ice tonight, ninth row, upper deck, so I'm ready. I didn't even bring the binoculars.
Oh, good. You got good seats, wow. I tell you, you got me in stitches over here.
And we have tonight's starting lineup. Stahl, Roosevelt, and then the switch, so I didn't get to see. Leeson and Gilroy are scratches. I'm watching the big video board outside. Injured reserve for L.A., Williams and two bats for me. Harold and Purcell are out. Like I care, because I don't know who any of these bums are. And it looks like it's face-off time, so I guess I should get inside because I'm going to miss the face-off. Let me find out if the phone will last. If it does, I'll stay on. But I wouldn't bet on it because I haven't seen a – I can't even get AT&T service to work in an open baseball stadium. So what are the odds on it working in freaking Staples Center, I ask you? I'm guessing slim and none.
Yeah.
And we're
Frank,
underway.
Well, I got to – okay, Frank. Well, I got to say, we loved having you on. I think you're a hit with the fans in the chat room.
If there are any sales of the DVD or CD copies of this, of course, I do want a profit sharing.
Oh,
yeah.
You're in.
Yeah, we got you on the 401K, Fred. Don't worry about it.
And burn me off my segment on a CD, would you? Because I don't think there's any fast forward on that website, and I don't think I want to sit there 2.5 hours to get to it. Hey, I'm one away from my prostate search.
All right. You will have that. And I got
to
say, I really like the fact
that... my pockets.
Okay.
Well, all right, Fred. Be safe getting through there with the veggie burger.
Crap, I got a hot wreck that's coming out of my pocket. This isn't going to be pretty. No. All right. We're dumping the quarters.
Can we talk to the security guard?
Sure.
Anyway, what a come down from Abel Francis.
I think that's a second to the camera.
Hello, New York.
Yeah, you're on internet radio right now.
Oh, hello, New York.
Hello, how are you?
No. Be right back.
This
is what happens to do a 3-hour show.
There you go. Now it'll take you 25 minutes to put this all stuff back where they belong.
Check his sleeves.
You guys still there?
Yeah. Did they get the veggie burger?
Hang on, I'm almost there.
Oh, we'll wait. Oh, we've got.
Oh, I can't take it. This is either the best radio or the worst radio. I can't.
Sure which. This is either compelling or crappy.
I'm not going to lie. If I'm a security guard at a game and I see a man coming in looking like Popeye, I think I'm going to want to frisk him.
Yeah.
You would want to frisk the guy.
And it only took an extra pass. My camera bag set it off. I told you, those zippers.
All right. Well, Fred, we must press on. We must...
We're
up against a hard break.
Well, if I can figure out where the frick the escalator is, I'll go in. Hey, it's still nothing, nothing. 1652 in. Hopefully that didn't spoil for anybody with a DVR.
All right, Fred, go find your seat. We'll talk to you next week.
Looks like we got the rookie in goal again.
Well,
enjoyed it. I look forward to talking to you guys again, and I've got my video shot, so I'll shoot for the.
There goes his AT&T.
Okay.
All right. Well. I'm not sure whether to say, "Oh darn, Fred, we lost Fred," or "Thank you, AT&T." That was the.
Hey Jim, I'm not going to say he blew your coverage away, but you know we didn't get that from you.
Yeah, you weren't trying to smuggle in.
No vegan meals in there for you.
Oh yeah. You see the pictures that were posted on Twitter last night of me doing the radio broadcast. Look at my fat ass. You see, and there ain't no veggie burgers going down my throat, pal. I look like but Tammy from Twitter came and saw us at the show on Saturday. She took pictures of me and put them on there. I thought the Fuji blimp was over the arena. then I realized it had headphones on. I said, "Hey, who's the fat guy? Who's the fat guy behind the laptop?" "Oh, that's me." Anyway, did we? James, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here, man.
thank you for hanging in there with us. Give us your take on the trade.
I hated it. I loved Higgins and Kotalik. I loved them guys.
Oh. All right. Well, thank you, James. Do you have a veggie burger up your sleeve?
Absolutely. I never leave home or stay home without one. we almost had a goal. Can you believe this?
I'm actually thinking of shoving a bag of pretzels up my sleeve to go to work tomorrow.
I also like how James is rejoicing that we almost had a goal.
We almost had a freaking goal, man.
We almost had a goal.
Nah, but this trade, man. I mean, there's nothing not to like about it. You know, like everybody said, you know, we got some grit. We got hopefully a little more scoring in Jokinen in there. Hopefully, he can, be that number one pivot we need for a little bit. If he stays, he stays. If he goes, he goes. We clear salary space. The other kid there, Proust, he fights. He's gritty. I mean, that's what we needed. We basically needed these two guys. And we got them in one shot. I mean, so I think as much as I hate saying that, he did a good job on this one.
Isn't it kind of funny how Chris Higgins gets traded from the Canadiens to New York, and there's the whole thing about the homecoming and the firefighters and the family and how great it's going to be playing back in New York, and 6 months later they trade him 2,500 miles away?
Well, he deserved it. He didn't do a damn thing, right?
I agree.
That's it. I mean, if he would have earned his keep and did what he was supposed to do, and get the fans on his side and score some goals and do some something timely when we needed it, it might be a different story. But the guy totally crapped out on us, didn't do a damn thing, and let him. He's out west now. Leave him there. Maybe
Chris,
he's better
Chris
off over
Higgins,
there. Maybe the pressure was too much for him.
Chris Higgins proving that you can't go home again.
You can't go home again. So forget about that Bon Jovi song, right? Who says you can't go home?
Well, it's true, though, James. What you said, it's the guy was like such fanfare about coming back to New York and, such a – just nothing.
Yeah, just nothing worked out. I mean, it was a total bust. Just like the Brashear, like you guys are saying, hopefully he's the next to go. Total bust. He's old. He can't fight no more. I mean, 5-10 years ago, nobody wanted the guys to get pounded by him. But, now he's the one that gets pounded. He takes a beating. Every time I see him fight, he takes a beating. He's getting concussions. The guy can't stay healthy. So, bye-bye, Brashear. If he has to go, let him go clear some more cap space. Whatever we can do to clear it up. And, then in a few years, maybe we'll get some of those guys that were on the USA squad, Stepan and, a couple of those other guys, man. Maybe in a few years with the defensive, defensive core we have, 2-3 years, might be a different story.
Yeah.
I saw something that said that Higgins had custom grips on his sticks.
Didn't work.
And, well, basically it was because he was gripping them too tight.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Hey, was it Ricky was just saying that the Capitals are looking for, might be interested in Brashear to protect.
It was Ricky.
Okay. Yeah. It was Ricky.
No longer.
Is there any chance the Caps are also looking for a slow, useless defenseman who's the best first passer in the game?
The best passer, best first passer, yeah.
Any chance of that?
I don't know. Ovechkin, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, no, come on.
This is Kevin Greenstein from the New York Sun.
Really?
Glenn, just wanted to get your sense on Wade Redden, what he's going to add to the Rangers' blue line core, and what you're thinking moving forward with regard to the defense.
We all know what the answer is, right?
I can't listen to that anymore.
I think we could do that together. I bet you we could all recite the rest of that.
Oh, yeah. Probably could. But now, seriously, think about it. If Pody goes down with an injury, Redden would be the perfect replacement.
Yeah.
Sure.
They're like twins.
You replace the number two most hated Ranger defenseman of all time with the number one most hated defenseman of all time.
Wait, but which one is number one? Is it Pody or Redden? I don't know. Pody was hated.
They can pair up with Eric.
And then going to the Islanders, I don't know, man. It's a toss-up with number one with those guys.
They could pair Redden with Marek Milik, and then Ozilinch could fill in.
Guys are all horrible. Jesus Christ.
Oh, yeah.
Personally, I didn't like Bill Horsham a whole lot.
Bill Horsham. But
penalty on Proust. First penalty.
Yeah.
Boarding. Here we go.
All right. Now, look. Guys, I want to also. All right, I got to compose myself. Hey, I'm
nice
a semi-professional. I wanted to say that there is some kind of cause of concern. You were talking about those young guys. Ryan Bourque suffered his second concussion this season.
Didn't know about that.
Yeah, that's a little bit of concern.
Absolutely. That's not good.
You know, I don't want to get too serious because basically this program is derailed into a place that I can't even get it back on track. But, it's cause for concern. And I don't know, do you think this is – let me get your opinion on this, guys. Do you think this trade is setting up another trade or there's going to be a flurry of – I can't really say flurry because the Rangers really don't have much wiggle room to make a lot of deals, but I guess they have a little bit more now. What do you think this is? There'll be pretty much silence to the trading deadline. We'll go with you, DB Maven, first.
It's Glenn Sather. That's all I have to say. It's Glenn Sather. There's something else brewing. It's probably in the works, and nobody's going to like it.
This is Kevin Greenstein from the New York Sun. Glenn, just wanted to get your sense on Wade.
I'm sorry.
He's torturing us. But I like it.
Ow, 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 ow.
A serious radio program devolving before our eyes.
Three hours might just be a little much for me. I think we lost the sanity right around 2:20.
Hey, you guys kept me from watching Bill Pito, so I'm happy. I'll listen to that guy going to the state for 5 hours if I don't got to look at him here, Pito.
Show.
Why, you don't find Bill Pito entertaining with his mascara? He's wearing, looks like a raccoon or whatever.
When him and Keenan are together, forget it. That's like one of the worst pairs I've ever seen.
What about Brian Leetch? Don't you find his deer in the headlights look enthralling?
But it's the depth of what he says that makes it so interesting.
Yeah, at least he knows what the hell he's talking about. The other two, I don't know where the hell they came from, really. Well, Keenan we know, but Pito, where the frig did they pick this guy up from? I don't know. Guy should be executed or something. I don't know.
He's not old at all.
Did Giannone really interview Mr. Magoo, or is that an internet rumor? Did he interview Sather? Did that happen?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
I think he was talking to Sather.
Did Glenn Sather appear on your TV set?
Oh, yeah, he was on the pregame show.
Oh, okay, what is
I don't know. I was listening to the guy going to the Staples Center, thank God.
Oh, yeah, thank God.
But it was an earlier interview, earlier in the day, and it's posted somewhere on the Internet. There was a transcription on one of the – it was the same crap.
Did they do the thing that they used to do on the old Conan show where he'd show a picture of the person and then the fake mouth was moving as he talked?
Yeah, did they pull any Ernie Kovacs skits out?
No, this was the quote unquote real Glenn Sather.
Ernie Kovacs? That's where he got the bit from with the moving mouth. That's the original Ernie Kovacs bit.
That's right.
I know the history of comedy.
What other Ranger program will have Ernie Kovacs references? Come on.
Yeah. Where the hell are you going to get from Ernie Kovacs, right?
I mean, what they need to do is hire what the hell is the guy who does the my brain just
Mike
went
Judge?
Dead on me. No, the guy who the
have a veggie burger
with some mustard and relish.
What an awful sandwich that's gotta be. I better eat nothing enough.
Don't
eat anorexia too.
Don't shove a roast beef sub up your sleeve or something. Bring a veggie burger. Jesus.
He must
live in LA.
He's a vegan.
Critical, wake up.
Hey, I'm here.
Oh, there you are. All right.
Well, Critical didn't weigh in on this trade.
Yes.
Well, I've been waiting and just the combo
left my ass off. Oh, Critical, man, you got to just jump in. You're going to get lost in the shuffle, you and your 165 pounds. You're in with the big boys now, my friend.
Yeah, really big boys.
Literally.
Bit 250-pound anorexics.
The Fuji blimp.
Somebody said before he was 250 pounds. I said, you must be talking about my fifth grade pictures.
I had one of those too. So,
all right, Critical. Man. So, where do you stand on this trade?
I am psyched about this trade.
You sound it.
Oh man!
I am so psyched. You sound like Brian
good
Leach.
Good riddance.
Are you Brian Leach, Critical?
No.
I am so psyched about this trade.
Yeah. But seriously, like.
What a great move.
You guys have seen Old Dogs Go to Heaven, right? The classic animated movie.
We're saving cap space.
No. In regards to Kuralik,
we have wiggle
room. I think he wants to tell a dog when he's leaving, he can never come back.
In regards to Kuralik.
Thank you, Dave.
I'm sorry, Dave.
All right, so I did not see that movie you're referring to.
Oh, man.
No, but let him speak. Let the man speak. Can we be serious here for a moment? Some decorum, gentlemen.
It's way too late for that.
I'm just waiting for him.
I'm due back at Bellevue in a few hours.
I'm waiting for him to quote another classic cartoon like the PJs or something.
You guys ever see Up in the Air? I mean, Up in the Air. That's a cool movie.
I haven't seen The Air, though.
Remember that scene in The Fox and the Hound?
No. I haven't even heard of The Fox and the Hound.
All right.
I can't even talk.
It's late.
We have
2 minutes left in the show. We're doing this again tomorrow night, aren't we?
Yeah. Sweet.
Oh,
my God.
Tomorrow night we're going to be on 8 to 10 tomorrow night, and we're going to talk to Mike Zippo, who is the organizer of the Fire Sather Rally. We're going to get his thoughts. We'll talk to him a little bit. And then, who knows what we're going to talk about after that.
Isn't that a Zippo lighter?
No, not the inventor of the Zippo lighter.
Yeah, no, actually he is, and we're going to ask him about that as well.
Yeah. And Critical. Ain't no Francis will join us. No.
He's still talking. Again.
He's still talking to sleep.
He's still on the line.
That interruption before his wife had to answer the blender.
Oh, God.
All right. I'm done. I'm out of here, guys. I'm going to go watch the game. Good night, everybody.
Have a good one.
See you, Mav.
You're quitting on us 90 seconds early?
All right. I'll stay for the whole 90 then.
We're missing the game.
Going down with the ship, my friend.
Hey, you guys were good.
What's going on in the game? Anything?
That's the
no score.
Score.
I'm watching on the web.
Nothing's changed. What a bust.
Nothing's changed.
Somebody
so
threw a veggie burger on the ice. Avery stopped to eat it.
I don't know about you guys, but I've never even seen a veggie burger anywhere because 240 pounds, you don't see veggie burgers or vegetables at all, you know?
Nothing to drool over.
That's when we're old. We're going to be dribbling and drooling. Sitting there, right, with a big bowl of food.
It'll be you a new tradition to throw veggie burgers instead of the octopus. The Rangers make the playoffs, we'll throw veggie burgers on the ice.
You'd have to dye a Milky Way green to get me to eat it. That's the closest thing I'll get to a vegetable.
I gotta go. Right. I gotta go to the bathroom. You gotta go to the bathroom.
All right. 10 seconds. Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Good
night. Right.
We'll catch you tomorrow, man.
Good show.
All right.
Show.
See you tomorrow night. I'm going
Definitely.
To watch Lost.
See
you.
Go ahead.
Bye. Right.
Oh my God.
Crazy.
Classic fun.
Good night, guys.
Good night.